Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to start by calling the workshop session to order. I'd like to welcome everyone to this afternoon's both workshop and action meeting of the Commonwealth Transportation Board. It's a great honor for me to be here on behalf of the Governor and, as you know, Secretary of Transportation. But before we start, I always like to begin our meetings with the Pledge of Allegiance. If I can ask everyone to please stand.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you all very much. And first, again, well, I want to thank you all for being here. I want to thank, obviously, the members for all being here and traveling some a great distance, some a little bit shorter distance, to be at this afternoon's session. This is my first meeting. I'm going to have to ask everyone's indulgence as I move along here. It's been a few years since I have chaired any sort of board. Although I feel fairly comfortable because during the years I used to chair that board, I used to always look down to my left and see my county attorney sitting on the dais with me, and I still see that she's there, but she's no longer my county attorney, and I'm no longer on the Board of Supervisors, but Sharon, hello. Let me all just, again, just pass along greetings from Governor McDonald. This is obviously a great time for us as we work towards this transition and into our new offices. Obviously, the governor was just inaugurated this Saturday. I had the opportunity to be sworn in on Sunday, and then obviously here with you today, just a few days later, at the first Commonwealth Transportation Board. I will say that had a great transition with Secretary Homer. Secretary Homer and I have known each other for many years, and I like to think that we had probably one of the best transitions because we were in constant contact and constantly going back and forth on issues even before we took office. And I'd like to thank him for his support and his friendship during this time period. And I wish him the best of luck as we move forward. In that vein, we are going to be looking to do something at the next CTB meeting to thank him for his service. Also for Commissioner Eckern, who's no longer acting or no longer commissioner. We have designated Greg Worley, the deputy commissioner, to be the acting commissioner while we undertake a search for a new commissioner. We've also had another change with the Department of Rail and Public Transport. Chip Badger has retired and has actually, I think, already begun his new job. The governor has designated a replacement for Chip, and that is Thelma Drake. Thelma, I'd like to thank you for assuming those duties and responsibilities, and we all look forward to working with you. With that, though, I'd like to maybe first start have a few words said by Acting Commissioner Worley about his upcoming tenure.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I've been called a number of things here lately, and the last one is like an old penny. I keep coming back. But I am excited about serving as the acting commissioner. It's a bit different from the last time around. My challenge then was to focus on performance measurement and to continue the reforms that you had started and when Philip Chiquette was here. And I think we did a pretty good job in getting that done. When I think about the challenge that's ahead of us now, it's a bit different. We now have a blueprint that was approved to address the budget shortfalls that we had. And I'm not going to go over the numbers, but we had some pretty serious budget shortfalls. And in that blueprint, there are a number of recommendations that's going to reorganize this department. And the former commissioner used to like to say, reshape the department. That's going to represent some major changes for us. We've gone through three phases. Phase one of that blueprint kind of dealt with some of the hourly staff, wage staff. Phase two kind of dealt with the reduction in force in staff as it relates to some of our engineering functions. And phase three, which is we've just issued some layoff notices for our phase three. But that phase three is a bit different from the first two phases. Phase three has a lot of things in it that's going to cause us to really look at all of our operating procedures and to make certain that those procedures are operating in a way that is effective and that we can handle those when we have 1,000 fewer staff. So this phase will be real difficult. So while we have launched this phase three and some of the hard decisions made regarding staffing, the work is just beginning because now we have to look at all those processes, business processes that we're going to have to redesign. And I tried to think of an analogy that would help describe this. And I started thinking my wife and I were remodeling a room in our home. And we had a plan, like a blueprint, and we laid out what she was going to do with the flooring and what we're going to do with the wall paints on the walls and the lighting. And we went through and we executed the plan and we did the flooring and we did the lighting and I started doing the painting. And I started the painting when she left home. And the time I got back, she said, you know, that's not the right shade of blue. And I said, but it's in the plan. And this is what we agreed we were going to do. And she said, but it just doesn't go together with the flooring and the lighting. And so, you know, we debated that plan and we reevaluated that plan. And I think you know where it's heading. We had to make some fine tuning and some changes to that plan. So when I look at this blueprint that we have today, when we started putting these pieces together, and particularly in phase three, we're going to have to do some fine tuning. We are committed to going forward with the blueprint, as is stated, but there's going to be some fine-tuning and adjustment, and that's the challenge that's going to be in front of us. And I believe, Mr. Secretary, we have a great team that we can get this done and get it done pretty quickly. So if you bear with me, because there will be some changes coming, but we will get it done. And I look forward to working with the board and this next few months.
Mr. Worley, thank you very much. I'd also like to ask if Ms. Drake would like, the Director Drake would like to say a few words as well.
Should I go?
Yeah,
there?
Please.
Well, Mr. Secretary, members of the board, and members of the audience who are here today, I am delighted to join you as the new Director of Rail and Public Transportation to think about the challenges that we face in the office with how to provide transportation choices for Virginians. How do we make sure that we're increasing mobility, reducing congestion? It's fascinating to me, and the amount of work that is done in that office, I heard repeatedly in the time between my announcement was made and showing up over at DRPT, what truly professional staff that is in that office and what incredible expertise that they bring. And I've seen that in the couple of days that I've been there this week. And, you know, we have challenges. All of us have challenges. How do we make sure that projects are done to meet the needs of the Commonwealth, to make sure that the funding is done properly, to make sure that taxpayers are getting what they expect to get for their dollars and to meet those goals of the agency. So I look forward to working with each and every one of you. I was delighted to learn that Virginia leads the nation in the number of telecommuters. Fascinating. Or think of the projects we're working on, the Dulles rail system, the Hampton Roads Transit, and again, challenges that are there. But I think all of us working together that we're going to have a very productive time. So thank you for letting me be here and say hello to you today. Thank you, Mr. Secretary.
Thank you, Director Drake. With that, we'll go to the first item on the work session. That's the ARRA update. Rita Busher and Mal Curley.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
While we're waiting for Ms. Busher, on behalf of the board, we'd like to welcome you as well and Director Drake. You'll find this to be a very experienced board. They've experienced the ups and downs of the revenue side and the ups and downs of the project selection process. And they understand more than anything else what Commissioner Worley suggested to us. In theory and practice are the same, and in practice they're not. So this is where the practice part happens, and I think you've got a pretty rugged set of decision makers here to help you as you move forward. So we welcome you, and we look forward to working with you as well.
Mr. Goulamay, thank you very much for the comments, and I do very much understand the caliber of the people on this board and the experience that's represented here. It is one of the things that as we move forward, I'm going to be reaching out to each one of you individually, both here when you're here in Richmond, but also I'm looking to try to get out into each one of your various districts and where you're from to meet with you and talk with you to discuss the transportation generally, transportation in your areas, but also to solicit your ideas about, you know, maybe ways that we can work on making the board even more effective and taking advantage of the great experience and knowledge and background of the members. So that's something I'm going to be soliciting your views on as we move forward, and I look forward to it very much. Ms. Busher.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, we'd like to update you today on the status of the what I'll call the RO1 funding project. As we've indicated to you previously, Virginia has met all statutory requirements for ARRA funding and will deliver our projects on schedule. Virginia's focusing its transportation funding on strategic investments that will create jobs, address infrastructure needs, and provide new transportation solutions for Virginians. We've been consistently showing this slide, which indicates that VDOT received $694.5 million in ARRA funding, of which $576.7 million was allocated by the CTB. There are 75 approved projects for the VDOT ARRA funding, and they are can be accumulated in the categories you see on the chart. The status of those 75 projects is 55 projects have been obligated to date with a total value of $401.5 million. 43 projects have been advertised with a total value of $381.5 million. And 40 projects have been awarded to date with a total value of $275.6 million. All remaining VDOT projects are underway with target obligation and advertisement dates. And what's important is that these projects will be obligated on March 2nd, 2010, which is the next ARRA deadline. As you know, any savings on projects awarded will go toward funding the approved contingency or other candidate projects that we've identified for you. And the awards to date have saved us approximately $56 million. And you can see the individual savings from several of the projects listed on the slide. The MPOs had a sub-allocation portion of the ARRA funding totaling $117.8 million. And, excuse me, those funds were sub-allocated to the five large MPOs, which is Richmond, Tri-Cities, Fredericksburg, Nova, and Hampton Roads. We've worked closely with the MPOs to identify the projects in their areas that meet the ARRA requirements and the goals. We'll continue to work with the MPOs to get their projects certified and obligated by March 2nd. The status of their projects, which are, there are 56 of them, 30 projects have been obligated, totaling $11.5 million. The obligations have come to date in the PE and right-of-way components of the projects. Actually, zero projects have been advertised, but five projects have been awarded. The reason there are five projects awarded is that we have flexed three projects in two in Hampton and one in Northern Virginia to the Federal Transit Administration. They were for transit-related projects. And two projects were PE and right-of-way only. And those were, we used task orders on existing PE consultant contracts to get those work done, or it was done in-house, one or the other, so it didn't have to be advertised. But all remaining projects are underway with target obligation and advertisement dates.
Well, sorry, before you leave this item, I mean, the deadline for them to have this obligated is which day?
March 2nd.
Okay. I would really, I had the opportunity to talk to VDOT staff, Ms. Busher yesterday and Ms. Kearney about, you know, what we can do to really encourage our MPOs, those members who are from districts or areas that have MPOs, what we need to do to make sure that the MPOs are engaged and are prepared to meet this deadline, because we do not want to see any of these funds disappear. So I would, we are putting together an effort to outreach the MPOs to remind them of these dates and do whatever we can do to assist them in getting their applications in, and more importantly, I'm sorry, getting their actually money obligated by the state. But I would also encourage the board members to reach out as well as CPB members.
The next slide isn't. I'm sorry.
Yes. Is there any indication they will not come close to the deadlines, or is it, you feel pretty assured that they'll be able to spend the money?
We've been actively working with the MPOs over the time. Fredericksburg put all their money on the Route 3 project, so they've obligated all that. I talked to Tom Hawthorne this morning, Richmond Tri-Cities, all their projects are on target. We believe Northern Virginia is on target. They have some of their MPO money with Fair Lakes, so we're a little bit concerned about that. And in Hampton Roads, I talked with Adam Jack this morning, our assistant down there in PE, and for about 75% of their projects, they think they're on target. They, down there at Hampton Roads, had several projects in different localities. What they did at their meeting last week, and I think he also told me there's a meeting today, they're talking about it. If they cannot meet their advertisement date on some of these smaller projects they have, they're passing a resolution to move all that money over to Princess Anne project. So we're optimistic and hope to move forward, and with the secretary's and this board's emphasis in that area, I think that we will make it. Yes, sir.
Optimistic.
The reason I ask is there are projects up our way we'd be delighted to substitute.
Well, and again, Mr. Davis, this number, I was briefed yesterday, you can't help but notice that essentially it's $15 million out of so far $117 million. They only got 6 weeks. So everything we can do to make sure that we help them along in this process, I think it's going to be important.
Do you actually have to have the resolution of the MPO, or can we make the decision if they are somehow delinquent?
It's their money. It's easier if they have a resolution.
All right. In the case that they haven't spent it or they haven't obligated the funds, these roll over into the federal system for reallocation?
Yes.
So we are not going to be able to recover them just here in Virginia from the MPO's work.
I believe actually Virginia can receive some of that at the state, VDOT.
But we're going to end up getting a share along with California and Arkansas and anybody else. Would it be possible just to put an update by the MPO on where they are for obligation for the next meeting?
Yes.
A little attention specifically to which MPOs aren't making the time frame. Granted, that won't leave them a lot of time, but it might encourage them not to show up on the list.
Okay. Rita talked about this being an ARRA-1 presentation because there is what we call an ARRA-2. It's a jobs package that's been passed by the House. We have had conversations with the Federal Highway Administration, also ASHTO, from a national viewpoint looking at this. Roughly, we would receive about the same amount of money, so that's in the neighborhood of, say, $700 million. We would have 90 days in the House version to have the work under contract. Before we had, that's 50% of the money, before we had 120 days to have the money obligated. There's a difference between obligated and under contract. In talking with Byron, we estimate somewhere between 50 to 60 days we would need once we advertise a contract, leaving 14 days for the contractors to bid on it, 14 days for staff to analyze it to ensure we have appropriate bids. I would ask, if we were at this point, I would ask the CTB to give the commissioner the authority to award all ARRA projects. Then we would have 30 days to get all the paperwork, all the DBE requirements, et cetera, together. So we're estimating between 50 and 60 days to, in that process, to have a signed contract. The FHWA has indicated that they would not exempt us on anything they're doing, so all the paperwork and everything we would have to do. Yes, sir.
Granted, this is the House and the Senate hadn't even acted, so that might, we might get some additional time. But I want to make sure I understand what you would be proposing is sort of a blanket.
Yeah, I'm not proposing that today. I'm just, what I would propose if we got to that point, that the CTB grant the commissioner the authority to award all contracts associated with ARRA. So, too, because what would happen is, in the time frame, we couldn't wait for a board meeting.
Would we have a list of...
Yes, we would. And I want to get to that in a minute.
May I just add one caveat? This 50% under contract within 90 days would include the MPO sub-allocation as well at this time. That's the House version.
We know how well they're doing.
Yeah, before in R1, the $117 million that the MPOs got, they didn't have a requirement that 50% of it had to be obligated in 120 days. They had all the way to March 2nd of this year. I'm already dealing with the district administrators and staff moving forward on possible projects we would have. It indicated we'd focus on a mix of projects. We had about $150 million of technology and operations projects that were not moved forward in R1 that Connie and her staff have got together. We have over-programmed. If you go back in and look at slide number, 3, I believe it was, if you add all those numbers up, it's about $698 million there. So we anticipate we're going to have some projects from R1 that we'd be able to use in R2. I have gotten with all the districts. We've identified about 50 projects that I'll call them shelf projects that we could get going in 30 days. And I've worked with the DAs, and they're moving forward on trying to do another 100 to 150 million paving contracts, maintenance-related contracts that fit the federal requirement. We talked about it, if you looked on that third slide we had where there's a little asterisk that said contingency contracts. I'm planning to look at every project, every candidate project that the board has approved. We're looking at it, Rita and I and staff are looking at it, anticipating ARRA 2. What this means, this board approved I-66 to be added as a candidate project. That is a design-build contract. It's about $70 million. I cannot move a design-build contract to contract in 90 days. So I would suggest that what we would do, I can advertise that before March the 2nd and obligate that money. Then what I would be able to do is look at the candidate projects we have and hold back $70 million of projects there that we would then advertise when we get the RO2. Now, the downside of this is if there is no RO2, there would have been projects that people were anticipating were going to be funded, but now that funding is not there because we moved other projects in front of it. So I'm looking for some board or the secretaries, commissioners, we talked about this yesterday, some flexibility that the department's going to view every candidate project that you have approved so far as we could advertise any one of those projects to move forward. And we're trying to come up with about $150 million of technology operation, about $70 million from existing projects we have, another $40 million from our shelf projects, and another $100 to $150 million. I'm looking that VDOT will be required to cover the MPO's 50%. In other words, if there's $694 million, we would have to cover $347 million within a 90-day period.
It's not 50% of the proposed.
Gotcha. That's a very let's just say we'd be predicting that a passage of something, and there a little event took place yesterday up Massachusetts, which kind of throws a great deal of uncertainty into the federal congressional decision-making process.
I can't wait until that's decided, because if we're not ready, we're not going to be able to get anything in 90 days. And if everything changes, then we can make adjustments.
Maybe a more, I don't know if I'll call it a cautious approach. Is there, you say, because of the 90-day, that's your challenge, and that may make you take some risks here on other projects. How many days do you need for a design-build contract such as 66 and just pursue that with our federal delegation, particularly in the Senate? And, I mean, a day such as 90 days is not as hard to get changed in some cases as other things. Do we need 180 days? Should we be seeking 240 days?
I'll take the highest number you can give me, sir. I haven't asked Tom that question. We've run into some problems with our design build as we do it because of various challenges, et cetera. I would imagine what I'm hoping to be able to do, as Rita indicated, we have gotten savings on projects we've advertised. So between March and September of this year, you know, I was hoping if we move in February with that design build contract, by August I would have that done. And if there's, for instance, if it comes in at $60 million instead of 70 or whatever the number, then we would advertise another project then.
I think, you know, that listening to the conversation, I think we have to assume it's not going to happen, but have the list and ready to go in case it does. I think maybe substituting some of these projects may not be a necessarily good idea. I think something we need to talk about a little bit more, but I think we have to assume that six-year plan as it stands today is going to be the six-year plan, but then have at least this list ready to go, Mel, and that we're able to pull the trigger in this time period if it does happen. I don't know, are we allowed to do at least electronic meetings, or
they have to be posted? Where's our lawyer?
We've got some restrictions on that.
There are restrictions. Because I just try to think that if this thing did move, and it moved very quickly, and we can come back to this, whether we can end up at least having this, you know, this continue having a list developed, and if it did happen, get this out to the board very quickly, and do at least then an information, and if we can do a vote, then do a vote. But We'll work that out logistically if it happens, and we'll work with the attorneys to make sure that everything meets. And if worse comes to worse, you know, we'll bring everybody in to just clear it. But I do think it's important that that we be prepared to pull the trigger if something were to happen.
Mr. Chairman, we're going to let our congressional delegation know that we are putting a list together and that there are some challenges with the 90 days, but we want the money.
Sure. I think that's prudent to do as well.
But the extent to which you can identify the days, give us 180 is what we need, then we have something we can act on with them. Really say, hey, instead of 90, we need 180 to effectively do this and go to the best projects rather than projects that qualify.
Mm-hmm. Is that okay with everybody? We'll get this list together, at least a draft. We'll circulate to folks. And then we'll start to have some. I'm planning on going up and meeting with the delegation in the next month or so anyway. And I'll carry the list around. Okay. After you all get a chance to look at it. Any other questions? Outstanding. We'll move to the next agenda item, and that is on the blueprint rest areas. And I'm going to ask Connie Sorrell to come up and do a presentation.
Good morning, Mr. Secretary, members of the board. If I can. This is it. I hope this will be one of the shortest presentations I ever give before the board. We'll see how it goes. This is a slide that shows all the rest areas, the 19 rest areas that we are planning on reopening. So this may look like another chart you may have had earlier. So this is a list of their location and by locality as well as their location on the various interstates. So we are in the process of recommissioning them, and there are a number of steps that we're having to take. We're working with the Tourism Corporation on the one in Manassas that had a small visitor center location there, and of course with the Department of Blind and Visually Impaired to get the vending machines back up and able to run, and with the state police, our emergency partners there. And we do have some issues with some of the facilities. As you know, they're older, and we're going to have to do some things with regard to their wastewater treatment systems and things to kind of get them going. So the good news is that we've got some soft openings of some sites that can actually be open in the next 30 days, and some others that will take a little bit longer because of their age and condition. And so this is a list of the schedules for reopening. So you can expect the first four out on Interstate 81 to be reopened by February the 17th, and the next group to be opened by March 17th, and the last group do have some more challenges with opening them, and the wastewater treatment plants particularly, some of their issues, but we expect them to be opened in some fashion, but available for opening no later than the 15th of April. And so just to share with you, in FY10, we only need about $3 million to be able to reopen them. It's about $1 million for the reopening costs themselves and a couple million dollars just to run them between now and the end of the year. So we do have some money in the reserve that we can use for that purpose. And so for FY11, when you adopt the budget, there will be an additional $7.4 million for the coming fiscal year for operations. And so the budgets are under development, and there are options that will be available. So, Mr. Secretary, if there are any questions of you or the members of the board?
Yeah, thank you very much. And let me discuss this issue on the cost so you understand where I think we're looking now on how to move forward. Is taking at least the initial $3 million for the rest of this fiscal year out of some reserve accounts that would at least pay for the reopening costs and the costs for operations for the rest of this year. After that, I think what we'd be looking, I know what we'd be looking to do is develop a plan to try to reduce these costs for the remainder of the fiscal year, but not just on these sites, but across the board, looking to come up with maybe some public-private partnerships on how to operate these, looking to the fact that they believe that the contract is up on all the centers, all the rest areas this year. Is that correct?
The contracts for just operating, for managing
right.
them, many of them are up for renewal. I don't have that information with me. I don't believe all of them, but I know that several of them are up for renewal for the cost of just keeping them clean and cutting the grass and that sort of thing.
And I know the one that, because I had the opportunity to talk with the contractor on many of the facilities that are closed,
yes.
and they did indicate that I think their contract is up this year.
Yes, some of them, yes. Well, we do currently have contracts that are available, so we don't have to issue new contracts to reopen them, but yes, there are some that are up for renewal.
So I think there's the opportunity to maybe take on a look at how we currently operate them, how we currently fund them, where there might be you know, ways to reduce utility costs of some of them by applying for various grants or employing green technologies, solar or whichever. We've already had an offer. We've checked this out on the Department of Corrections is willing to provide personnel to actually do some of the cutting and some of the basic maintenance. So there's a lot of options out there. So we'd be looking to maybe put together a plan to, and I'd like to involve the board on this, to help us look at long-term funding options to reduce this number, not just on these sites, but all from across the board. Are there any questions? As I think there is, when we start the action agenda for the real board itself, I think there's an opportunity to move forward on this matter today, if the board is in agreement with that. I know that there is an opportunity. We were able to do it today. The original concept was that we thought we'd put this on this meeting to discuss it, and then to, you know, potentially bring this up for a vote in February. However, I think there's an opportunity to actually have the governor come over this afternoon if the board was amenable to actually amend the agenda and have him here when we actually we'll have him come over and say a few words, and to have him here when we actually vote, if we were to be able to vote for it today.
Mr. Chairman, would a motion be in order to amend the agenda to allow that to happen so you can get word to him that we'll take a vote on it?
Mr. Davis, I think the proper, because it goes back to Ms. Pandak, I always used to look to Ms. Pandak on these issues, but I think when we come to, if the board is just generally, like I was saying, generally in agreement with that, when we come to the action agenda, would be the first item would be to actually move to amend the agenda. And then we can send word to the governor to be here. I've already got an indication he can be here around 3 o'clock, if that's acceptable. Whatever.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's safe to say we've debated this, discussed this, everybody's read through it and thought about just when we took the action in the first place, so I don't think there's anything to be gained by waiting another month. So I don't think, unless somebody voices otherwise, I can't see that there'd be opposition to voting today.
Is everyone okay with that? Great. And we'll move. Yes, Ms. Golay.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to make a comment. This was a very contentious issue for us when it was actually put to a vote last year. And I know any of us would remind ourselves that it was in the context of some pretty big wholesale reductions across the board, everything from transit operations to maintenance to technology and signage. Most of the money that we've reduced over the last 2 years has been in the construction budget. So this is a painful step for us, but it was part of a series of painful steps, and I just wanted to make sure everybody understood that. No one doubts that even though the discussion was had at the time. No one doubts that rest stops play an important role in the transportation system. Also, most of us agreed that many of our rest stops were located at a different time and in places that you wouldn't necessarily draw them up and put them there now. Thirdly, we've all traveled enough, and even with our own state, we've seen what happens when you really invest in these centers, and they become more than simply a bathroom and a vending machine. They actually do present and can present a very positive face of the state to travelers. The challenge, I think, for us is to, as we take this additional step, to always consider what our policy is about rest areas, you know, how we do fund them. The latest idea that I heard this weekend was locate new ABC stores at the rest stops. Generate a revenue stream. And it's a public body, so you wouldn't have that private person. But what I mean is it just shows that people actually are trying to think about the best way to solve this problem as a part of a set of larger problems that we face. So,
thank you, Ms. Coulman. Is anyone else have any comments? And let me just say that everyone who is, has followed this issue and the previous vote, everyone understands the dilemmas that this board has had to face on matters like this. I think one of the things that as we've come to learn is that these rest stops, I mean, they are in many ways a public face to Virginia. Many people may end up, unfortunately, their only stop in Virginia may be one of these rest stops on their ways to other places. We'd hope, though, that they would stay a little bit longer than just stopping at a rest stop. But it is something that it's ended up taking, changing people's views and when they see these along the interstates. It's obviously been something that the governor has heard many times over the past year, or ever since this action was taken. So I think he very much appreciates that the board would entertain having the opportunity to have this vote today and to reopen the stops as soon as practical. And it's something I think that will be very widely positively received. So, thank you. I will. I hope you don't mind, though. The one issue I will not be taking back to the governor is the putting up ABC stores at the rest area. But Mr. Coulombe, you keep on thinking outside the box. The next item is the repeal of the professional and non-professional services provisions, and Linda Chiu.
Good afternoon. Mr. Secretary and members of the board, you are being requested to repeal a notice that's placed in the administrative code which tells the public where they can come and look at a document. We will be placing the notice in a section called guidance document, trying to save some trees, and all this occurred before the advance of the internet and being able to link things. So we are not repealing any regulations per se, just a notice that's in the administrative code. And I'll be glad to answer any questions that you may have.
Boy, you're even shorter than the last person. Well, I hate to ask you this. We have a presentation?
Would you?
Could you? I'm new to all this. So.
I'm technologically challenged. Thank you. These documents used to be part of the department policy memorandum, and they're obsolete because they've actually been replaced by documents that are online. It was last revised in 1991. And all of the things that we do are covered by current manuals or manuals published by other people, like the Department of General Services. We started the process of repealing this, and at the same time, the Office of the Attorney General's Task Force had some recommendations that we could increase our efficiency and reduce bureaucracy, and suggested that we combine them. But as we looked at it, we realized that they really were obsolete documents. And so we've reviewed them, we've discussed them with the Attorney General, and they have concurred that they could be repealed. And there's a chart on page 6 that outlines the three that we were looking at. Only one was adopted by the CTB, and this is the one that is before you. And it will be filed as a guidance document.
Gotcha. Any questions? Mr. Worley, I have to ask you, do we have, an ongoing effort to identify policies and provisions like this that can be eliminated or refined or revised?
I don't think we have a formal process, Mr. Secretary, but what I was mentioning earlier today, when we started looking at all of these processes that need to be changed based upon the implementation of the blueprint, I believe that a lot of our policies and procedures will be examined at that point in time, and you will see some changes. It was probably about 5 years ago, I believe, was the last time we really did a good look at the department's policy memorandum to see what needed to be changed. But since then, we really haven't done a wholesale review. But I believe that the opportunity will exist when we start implementing the blueprint recommendations.
And sorry, you said one thing that intrigued me. And since it's only my third day, I can ask lots of questions.
Any questions you want?
Thank you. Only those. So, which are actually approved and actually are under the, I'm going to say, the responsibility or authority of the CPB. Which are those?
Of the ones today, only the one that just says that the regulations describing these services are available to review in the public.
Question is, maybe it's Mr. Worley, is which ones come under, how do we decide which ones come under the CPB and which ones don't? I'm just saying not just
right,
specifically with this, but just generally.
Generally, any policies or that, I guess, represent policy guidance that you want to issue to the staff would come under that, like, department policy memorandum. For example, you have a policy that says any contract over $2 million must be awarded by the board, and those under $2 million could be signed by the commissioner. Now, that's more of a policy guidance that you would be given to staff. So any that type of guidance would come from the CTB. And we do have a department policy memorandum book that I could share with you that contains some of those policies.
Does everyone in the CTB get one of those copies or no? Do you all provide it?
I think as a new member, we got all that material as a new member.
I think we do. We all have a manual that's about that too.
Yeah, the manual, though, is just a general manual about the CTB and its operations, right?
I think, Mr. Chairman, I think that I have something called a policy memorandum.
Okay.
I think I do.
We do get them because in July I was given one, so yes, did you have it? That document's in there.
Do we ever, do we ever try to do training or overviews of it? Other than you all got it, I got lots of binders.
Yeah, that's the training I got. I got a binder that said, "Here you go."
Okay.
It wouldn't be unwelcome.
Yeah. Dickens, I'm sorry.
It wouldn't be unwelcome to have an opportunity to do some training.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if it might be useful at some point for us, maybe just to, every meeting, just go through different sections. Be looking at and give us an opportunity to go through some of these and see if there might be some things you all might want to change, or at least have folks start to look at changing or eliminating. We're going to keep you busy.
That's okay. No problem.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. The next item is the Richmond Hampton Roads Passenger Rail Study Update. Mr. Page.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. I'm here today to provide you all with an informational update. This is the kickoff to what we are going to have next week, which you'll hear a little bit more about, our series of three public meetings to provide input from the public on our Richmond Hampton Roads Passenger Rail Project Draft Environmental Impact Statement. This has been an exciting project for us here at DRPT. As this board has been well briefed over the prior administration over the last 18 months, we've taken some significant strides and challenges forward in advancing passenger and freight rail initiatives, and thank you, Commonwealth Transportation Board, for your efforts and support on that as well. Our project that I'm going to talk about today is how we develop Hampton Roads Passenger Rail. An environmental impact statement is necessary for the designation of a corridor for high and higher speed rail in order for us to receive federal funds under the NEPA process. The Federal Railroad Administration has been the lead agency at the federal level, and the Department of Rail and Public Transportation has been the lead agency on behalf of the Commonwealth as we've moved forward in this study process. And just remember, as I've briefed the board before, the Southeast High-Speed Rail Corridor, as originally designated by Congress, did not include the leg, the connecting leg between Richmond and Hampton Roads. The Commonwealth felt it very important to have this leg, what they call the Hampton Roads extension to the Southeast Corridor, added in administratively, and the Federal Railroad Administrator at that time added that section of the corridor, which now allows us to be here today to talk about how we will advance high-speed and higher-speed rail to this region, as well as hopefully qualify for federal funds. We had several alternatives that were evaluated. But we did not come forward in the document that we released on December the 4th with a preferred alternative. We felt that this was certainly a very strong and significant input process at the region, which members Dickens and Lane have been very instrumental in working with us on. I want to thank you for those efforts and those meetings you've attended as well. Plus, the Hampton Roads region, the Richmond MPO, and also the Tri-Cities MPO have also come in regionally as we move forward with this process. Again, federal funding is very critical to us in how we advance this program and how we advance high-speed rail in Virginia. We will apply for federal funds to go to the next level of support for these projects once the preferred alternative is designated. And also, the Richmond-Hampton Roads project in this document, which I know that these two members from Hampton Roads are very familiar with this, is that we also wanted to set forward a strategy as to how we're building a passenger rail system in Virginia. Not one that had inoperable segments, not one that was relying on other states and other cooperative agreements as to how we move forward. Well, we wanted to come forward with a plan and strategy where we connect Hampton Roads with this document. When we originally started out with this document, we talked more specifically, the region did in the southern half of Hampton Roads, as I'll talk about in a minute, the Petersburg to Richmond was a segment that we assumed would be developed as part of the Southeast High-Speed Rail Corridor. I want to be very clear to this board that if we wait for that corridor to be developed, then in this document, we are saying we're going to wait for Richmond to Raleigh to be developed before we can advance the initiative to Hampton Roads, if South Hampton Roads is the logical termini. So then, again, no alternative depends on the completion of any other project, and I want to be very clear that that's where the path we're going in this document. We have two routes, five alternatives that were studied. There's an existing route called the Peninsula Route, which goes down CSX Transportation's lines from Main Street Station, which is about two blocks to the east of us here, down to Newport News. And also we have the Southside Norfolk Southern Route, which includes about 25 miles or so of Richmond to Petersburg on CSX's former Atlantic coastline. They call that the A line, as well as following the old Norfolk and Western line that Norfolk Southern operates today to the city of Norfolk. We had in those five alternatives routes, frequencies, and speeds, and also, as I'll go through, we also had some environmental considerations under NEPA, which was a requirement. The alternatives under consideration, status quo is where we today operate down to Newport News. That was two trains under the existing service, as well as the no action alternative, which was the baseline alternative for this document, included the addition of one train to the Hampton Roads region. As this board may remember, back when we were working on the Richmond project and the Lynchburg project with Amtrak, their original proposal came in with a plan to initiate a third frequency out of Newport News. However, due to financial issues and the timeliness of being able to execute that, we are working out of Richmond and Lynchburg on those two train alternatives. As well as we move forward, alternative one included the Peninsula CSXT routes to continue with its contemplated baseline of three trains at 79 miles an hour with some service efficiencies and enhancements as we move forward with that project, as well as the Southside route would be a higher speed route with a 90 to 110 mile an hour service. And that would include a frequency increase over time, and again, this is a 20-plus year document, over time of an increase of 6 frequencies to the South Bank, which we refer to as the southern region south of the James River. Alternative 2A actually flipped that scenario. 6 high-speed trains to Newport News, 3 conventional trains to the Norfolk Station and Bowers Hill out in the Suffolk Chesapeake area. And alternative 2B was a consideration of using the existing route with no additional service to the southern Hampton Roads region, and then improvements obviously leading that to the 90-110 mile an hour scenario. So again, I've just gone through that. Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman.
So I'm sorry. So what is the definition of high-speed rail?
High-speed rail, in accordance with the guidance from the Federal Railroad Administration the stimulus, was you have current standard rail, which is conventional rail, which is up to 79 miles an hour. You have higher speed rail, which is 90 to 110 miles an hour, and 110 up is considered to be high speed rail, as you see as it operates in the northeast corridor today. That's the process and the definition. What we have as a nation of states that are trying to develop passenger rail services, we have worked with the Obama administration through their guidance to identify that you have what we call emerging high-speed rail corridors, which that's where you get from the 79 to the 90, and then the 90 to 110 is the next level as to how we incrementally build a high-speed rail corridor network for our nation.
So I'm sorry, but I mean, so we have current, then we have higher, and then there is no anything higher than 110?
At this moment, the only high-speed rail over 110, sir, that we have is the northeast corridor operates in certain sections up to 130, 35 miles an hour.
So, I'm just trying to understand. So when they are looking to do this incrementally, is this part of the policy issues that they're still grappling, whether they have go right to high speed or we go to this higher speed before we get to high speed?
Right, that is correct. And to clarify, if I may, up to 90 miles an hour, the Class 1 railroads in the United States, for the most part, have set the bar to say that we will allow trains to achieve 90 miles an hour and be commingled with our freight operations. That's a very strong point to take away today. Now, that's considered to be an emerging high-speed corridor under the current FRA, Federal Railroad Administration, guidance for high-speed rail. To go to high-speed rail, 110 miles an hour, most Class 1 railroads are going to tell you, we want you on autonomous insular right-of-way. And there is an extreme increase in cost between 90 and 110. And as I go through today, the travel times and the differentials between 90 and 110, you will see that in some regions and on some corridors, the difference between 90 and 110 on less than 100-mile corridor, the time savings is not that great, but you will find that it's a pretty wide gap there of additional investment to get to that insular right-of-way.
I'm sorry, for the grants that we've applied for, have all the states applied for these grants or no?
Not all states have applied for the grants. Under the original guidance, it required that you, under Tier 2, which is the high-speed corridor program grants, which our $1.8 billion application is part of, there was a requirement that you had a programmatic level of environmental documentation. At the time when the applications went in, the only states that had achieved a Tier 1 documentation for corridor-long initiatives were Virginia and North Carolina. All other states were either trying to achieve a Tier 1 document for programmatic environmental work or had plans through their application to do that. So that is a challenge that the current administration is certainly, as you obviously referred to, as grappling with. That's one of the challenges of the current FRA administration as they work through this program. Who is ready and who is not, and are we going to develop a 110-mile-an-hour faster system, or are we going to concentrate more on connectivity of like Virginia's plan, where you use train sets that exist in the corridor today between Richmond and Washington that can operate, because they operate in the northeast corridor, at speeds in excess of 110 miles an hour. So therefore, you concentrate more on connectivity and enhancements to corridors, where you get to 90 miles an hour on existing railroad alignments with obviously enhancements, and not have to go out and develop new technologies for passenger train sets, which will take a lot longer than I think what the intent of the legislation was, and that was to enhance the connectivity and also stimulate job growth and connectivity for economic development.
And I'm sorry, the new service that we're funding from Lynchburg to Washington, that's less than 90 miles an hour?
That service runs at about 79 miles an hour, and once it gets into the Northeast Corridor, just to re-educate everyone, this is a Northeast Corridor train that actually has an origination in Boston and a termination in Lynchburg. That train operates at higher speeds north of Washington, D.C. South of D.C., it runs as a conventional train at conventional speeds that Norfolk Southern will allow.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Kevin, isn't that also true for the Newport News, Richmond to D.C.?
Yes, sir. Mr. McCarthy, you're exactly right. The train sets that run out of Newport News and the two trains now soon to be a third train out of Richmond due to the Virginia subsidy train, they are also the high-speed train sets. We call them high-speed. They're called Capstone 2s. They're an Amfleet car that has a high-speed set of wheels under it that can run at the speeds in the Northeast Corridor. And that's what's been so appealing to us in Virginia and how we brought this plan forward is that we already have connectivity to a high-speed rail line, and we have that, like you said, that equipment in place today that operates in the Northeast Corridor at higher and high speeds. So our plans and our proposals as we come forward as an agency is how we make best use of the scarce limited resources and also develop a system in Virginia that gives you a higher speed opportunity in short pattern links where 90 miles an hour is actually time competitive and you don't have to have your own insular right of way to go to 110 where the time savings is not really that great.
Mr. Chairman, we also have applications in for hundreds of millions of dollars to improve service in that corridor, is that right?
In the Richmond-Washington corridor, we have the $1.755 billion application for the stimulus funds.
And what would that actually accomplish if we were so fortunate as to receive it?
If we are fully funded, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, what we have is a series of 19 projects with many subcomponents that will develop a corridor that we feel with the existing services today will have 90 mile an hour and potentially a higher speed increment between Washington and Richmond and also set Main Street Station into a network that includes the north-south trains that go through Virginia from Florida going south, including the Carolinian, and also the origination and termination of the regional trains that are at Staples Mill today. So we would bring the terminal to downtown and also have that as a new termini on logical termini for that, and also the run-through opportunities from as far south as Florida and all the way as far north as Boston will be brought to downtown Richmond.
Ms. Panda.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Page, you may have to dumb this down for me, but some of us have been to places like Europe where there are these super high speed, I guess you call them trains. In order to get to that, you need, as I understand, you need a separate line or track, and you need a different type of train to go to those higher speeds. So the hybrid in the 90 to 110 range is where we are right now in terms of state of the art on the same tracks.
Right, that's correct. And let me bring Europe to America for just a minute. The only high-speed rail line that we have that's remotely anywhere near what you've ridden on in Europe is the Northeast Corridor with the Acela Express service. Anyone who's ridden a conventional train, I know, Mr. McCarthy, you ride it regularly, up into the Northeast Corridor, you'll be doing 90, 95 miles an hour on one of the regional trains out of Richmond, and you'll have the Acela go by you pushing closer to 100, 110 miles an hour. That bullet train, so we call it that, it has a funny nose on it, similar to that. The Acela train is running at a higher speed. It's also running commingled with the Amtrak service, but it's electrified service. That's how they can achieve the higher speeds. Fossil fuel locomotives, for the most part, are geared to about 110 miles an hour. So to answer your question, yes, we will need electrification in order to achieve higher speeds, as well as the dedicated rights of way because of the safety issues that have been identified by the Class 1 railroads about running super fast trains and slower freight trains together. I want to be very clear to the board that freight service does operate in the Northeast Corridor today, but it operates at night when the passenger trains are not operating. but that there's a different ownership arrangement with Amtrak owning the corridor and the railroads, the freight railroads, basically achieving that access through the Conrail acquisition and those rights that came with that on the passenger rail line.
And I'm sorry, you might not have this off the top of your head, but I mean, the rights away, I mean, the Class 1s, I think, abandoned some like 100,000 miles of right-of-way back in the 90s. Is there a right-of-way existing today, unused right-of-way, that any of our Class 1s continue to hold that you could ever do a separate, you know, a separate line for passenger rail, or no?
On the study corridors, the Southeast High-Speed Rail Corridor, this is a very good question, is that for many miles south of Petersburg, Virginia, the CSX Railroad abandoned the line that runs from Norlina to Petersburg. That is a gravel roadbed today that will actually be the fastest piece of railroad we will have in Virginia. That's 110 miles an hour. And that speed is obviously strapped because of the fossil fuel locomotive. It will not be electrified. So to answer your question, there's a piece of right-of-way, a segment that we're going to reutilize. As well as I go through the alternatives analysis that is part of this presentation today, I will call to your attention where we're actually using part of the old Virginian rail line through the city of Suffolk and over as to how we will get to Bowers Hill, where there's a proposed station on a piece of abandoned railroad that currently is sitting in ownership under Norfolk Southern. So we have tried to maximize as many miles of abandoned rights-of-way as we can find and locate. The challenge between Richmond and Washington is that there are no abandoned rail lines in that corridor. It's always been a very lucrative corridor that did not have duplicated rail services, and that is what has been our challenge between Richmond and Washington on trying to identify any higher speeds than 90 miles an hour.
Secretary, that's yes, interesting note of the you talked about competition from other states. There's essentially $8 billion on the table across the country, and there's $102 billion worth of applications for that $8 billion. So if we get our full 1.7, we'll be doing very, very well.
Right. That's a very good point to make. Thank you. If I can head on into the presentation, are there any more questions, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, before we run through the alternatives? But thank you for that. Now I'll know to be specific to point out some areas where we're trying to reutilize rights of way as well.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry. I recognize that the board may have been through these issues before. But when I recognize this is an EIS and that it's a separate, quote-unquote, effort. But when we put in for the stimulus grants, I mean, since they are there to help generate economic activity, I mean, how much do we really look at and engage the business sector in helping develop these proposals and to help push these proposals? Because obviously, I mean, you can imagine, and we're already seeing it, the enormous amount of, let's say, commuter traffic already, people living in Richmond area driving to Washington or Richmond Hampton Roads or vice versa. I mean, so how much do we look to engage the business sector to make sure that we really do get economic activity out of these projects?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. What we did as part of our statewide rail plan process and also our statewide rail resource allocation plan that was developed immediately after that as to how we propose to help pay for some of this in these passenger rail plans is that we actually looked at transit-oriented development, for example, as ways that the local governments could achieve revenue streams to assist the Commonwealth in local terminals and facilities and station facilities in particular. We certainly feel as we move forward that we also have a very good working relationship with the private railroad industry. Norfolk Southern and CSX worked very diligently, and this board in its previous administration approved for execution framework agreements between the Class 1 railroads and the Commonwealth as to how we will develop corridors for both freight and passenger rail services and those joint benefits. So we did go into certain locations along this rail corridor, especially from Richmond to Washington and on down to Newport News, as to how transit-oriented development could be used as a revenue stream and some other land use capabilities, as well as to how we engage that economic development that has spawned and basically a beneficiary of these passenger rail improvements.
Yeah, because, I mean, if you ever look at people who, you know, put their money where their mouth is, look at Dulles Rail, where the property owners in the local area, you know, voluntarily coming together and voted themselves an increase to spur that development because it benefits them.
Yes, it is. Thank you. Any other questions? All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll move into alternative one. We have some graphics now that may be a little easier to follow. Alternative one, as I mentioned earlier under the baseline scenario, we continue conventional speed operations on the current existing CSX transportation alignment between Main Street Station and Newport News. And then coming south out of Richmond, and again, there's a lighter blue line there between Richmond and Petersburg, and I want to be very clear to you, Mr. Chairman, and the members of the board and the public here today, that alignment is also the Southeast High-Speed Rail Corridor alignment that will be used to go to Raleigh, North Carolina. We feel, and we have included in this document, there is a cost number that is associated with that as we get into this. But as I go into these graphics, I want to be very clear to you all that there is some overlap in plans, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. But and again, as I was mentioning earlier, we want to come forward with a strategy and a system as to how we go from Main Street Station to Norfolk and Main Street Station to Newport News without a section of what we refer to as an inoperable segment that we have to wait for another project to be built before we get there. Moving ahead on alternative 2A is higher speed, north bank, as I mentioned earlier. The flip is conventional speed on the south bank of the James River. That would be three trains at 79 miles an hour to Norfolk, and the higher speed would take us up to 90 miles an hour, up to six train frequencies to Newport News. Alternative 2B provides no connectivity to the south bank of the James River. Very high population center that would be served by having to cross the channel, the James River, to get on the train there at Newport News. Alternative 2B, as we move forward, you can see has direct access using the existing CSX route that we use, that Amtrak uses today for connectivity. As we go forward, I wanted to brief the board on how we have moved forward with a process up to this point on evaluating the alternatives. We did start with public scoping. We had a technical working group. That's the acronym for that is TWG, T-W-G. That technical working group was both out of local businessmen and women and also local appointed or elected officials of the local jurisdictions along the rail line. So this gets back to you, Mr. Secretary, when you were asking about how do you involve the public and also the private sector. We did under our technical working group process as well. We worked through this process. We prepared the Tier 1 draft environmental impact statement. And where you see the star there is where we are beginning today. Public comment began when we posted the project on the website, the document, on December the 4th. I believe the board members received a mailing. I think it was dated December the 18th of a compact disc, a CD, with the document, as well as how we've moved forward with providing printed documents. And this is about the size of a small urbanized area phone book, by the way. This is the environmental document that the public has been provided at all libraries along the way and other public places for review and document comments. In the middle of all of this, we've worked very closely, and the members of the Commonwealth Transportation Board have helped us champion this as well. We actually had the Hampton Roads region come together on October the 30th and take action prior to the to this public information effort, so they could come forward as a region to actually state what they as a region felt was the priority and the alternative. And on October the 30th, the Hampton Roads Transportation Planning Organization voted into passage a resolution that basically endorsed a high-speed south bank and the conventional with some minor enhancements to the north bank, which ultimately falls out to be similarly alternative one as you move ahead today. Last Thursday night, I was at the Tri-Cities MPO meeting in Petersburg, and they, the Tri-Cities MPO, also endorsed a resolution for alternative one as we move on. Travel times between cities, terminal cities, is very critical in understanding. As I go through this, I'll be talking about the cost of what it takes to go from 90 to 110 and what that time savings will be. Here we see the travel time savings as we move forward. What we'd like to see under status quo is we do an hour and 25 minutes travel time between Newport News and Richmond today. That's on a good day. We have some on-time performance challenges there that I want to be very clear. CSX and the Commonwealth have come together under a Rail Enhancement Fund grant to actually go out and design the 30% of capacity improvements and the 30% design to help move that forward. So that's a Rail Enhancement Fund grant underway today. As we move forward again, the 90-mile-an-hour peninsula route to Newport News is an hour and 3 minutes. And I wanted to point out to the board, you see over there under miles, Newport News jumps from 73.9 to 75.9. And again, remember I made the comment earlier that we're trying to connect downtown localities to downtown centers as well. Yes, sir.
On that topic, may I ask, is there on the north sideline, the current CSX, is there any place that the train would actually achieve a high speed?
We have certain sections we've identified under the 90 mile an hour scenario and 110, but it would require some alignment adjustments and some substantial improvements.
Just looking at the geography and the number of stops, I'm just looking at the time differences. I'm just questioning is it ever, even if it could, get up to speed to do that.
Right, and thank you, Mr. Lane. Looking back at the map, if I call your attention to the graphic, obviously from Petersburg to Norfolk is a straight shot, literally, no pun intended, to Suffolk, and then it's relatively straight through the Dismal Swamp around to Bowers Hill. From coming down the route, of course, along the peninsula from Newport News up, it's obviously it's a concentrated area. We cross a reservoir there, but it's relatively straight where some speeds can be achieved. Coming through the Chickahominy Swamp is a little bit more circuitous. We're winding around some areas there. But the answer is yes, we do have areas that we can achieve it, but it isn't as consistent and constant as we could out of the Norfolk area. Thank you.
Just a question, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
On the Dismal Swamp, isn't that a federally protected area or something, or is there a track already there?
Well, and that gets back to the reutilization of abandoned roadbeds. The old Virginian line actually crosses on what's up on the headwaters there of the Dismal Swamp. The earthen mound and roadbed are still in place, and that's the alignment we propose to use when we step out to go to Bowers Hill. So it's on higher ground. We will minimize, yes, sir.
The impact.
Yes, sir. There is an impact. It is identified as I go through in one of the slides. We took an account of that. Thank you, Mr. McCarthy. But, again, it's a reutilization of an abandoned railroad right-of-way. Looking again at the south side alignment, 130, an hour and 35 minutes versus an hour and 27 minutes is your differential in time savings between 90 and 110. And obviously from the peninsula, we're looking at 57 to an hour and 3 minutes. So back to your comment, Mr. Lane, there are a few achievable locations where we can see time savings, but then again, time and distance is very narrow here, so no matter how fast you go, you can only save so much time.
Sorry, Mr. Page, I had to ask you, so there's no crossing of the James River at all?
No, sir. And thank you for asking that question. We looked at a 4.4-mile alignment that would actually cross the channel. And it was parallel to the 17 bridge at $590 million, that alternative was considered and quickly dismissed. We found that that alignment plus the additional trackage on the south bank in order to get back over to Norfolk would cost almost as much, if not more, as you'll see, as some of the alternatives that we had by using existing rights-of-way.
So the when we have talked, and obviously speaking about some of the tunnel projects down there, including the third crossing, have they ever examined whether to put rail through there to make this all connect better?
Yeah, I think your question is referencing the multi-purpose tube that was there was an additional tube, I believe, that was originally contemplated under the third crossing. That tube we did evaluate, but I think under the constraint long-range plan, the tube is no longer a part of that. So falling back under the CLRP, we took into account that the third crossing would exist, but we're not able to use the tube as an opportunity because it would not be constructed.
I'm just sort of raising issues I don't necessarily have answers to, but you would think of all places that rail could really work in Virginia right now would be the Hampton Roads, just because of the conductivity problems. And if you had a rail, I mean, it would help commuting generally.
Right.
Dramatically, particularly because you have enormous concentrations of employment in certain areas, particularly near North, like North Portsmouth.
Mr. Secretary, let me be the first to agree with that.
Now, why would you say that?
Secretary, I'll second. Right. Right.
Mr. Chairman.
Spandek.
I do recall, and a small amount of that discussion since I came on the board, and my recollection, and I would, maybe you can elaborate on this, was the reason why it's not in the constrained long-range plan for that additional tube to be there for rail is because it would have extended the time frame for doing EIS or do a new EIS, is that correct?
No, if I may, the third crossing is out of the long-range plan. It's not really a doable project at that point in time.
There's no funding associated with it, and although it was used for ridership numbers, which is
right.
Here in the public hearings, some people will contest, because mm-hmm. you're basing ridership, people moving back and forth across the Hampton Roads Channel, but based on an assumption there's a third crossing, when in actuality there is not one there, and probably will not be one there.
Mm-hmm. But in the perfect world, the line comes down the north bank, if you will, the peninsula to Newport News, crosses through the tube at the third crossing and goes to the south side. But there's just a little problem with funding for that third crossing, and it's not going to happen anytime in the near future, so alternatives are...
Right. And if I may just, excuse me, if I may, on the feasibility of the third tube, I don't want to get into what people accuse me of becoming a geek real quick, but heavy railroad locomotives cannot go down and back up again, like your automobile can go through those tubes on those channel crossings. So just bear in mind that you need a lot more distance in order to achieve the same grade with a railroad locomotive. So I just wanted to point that out as well. That's why we opted for the bridge, as we considered to be somewhat of a still an alternative, is to say that we did look at the connectivity, the same common sense question you asked. Why don't you just cross the channel? So that's what we did, and that's where we came forward with an alternative considered but quickly dismissed because of the cost associated with it.
Mr. Page, you got one of those engineer hats?
Well... I'm a common sense engineer, unfortunately. I have a PE. not to any these guys with PEs that work for me have a lot of common sense as well. That's just
Mr. Chairman, yes. In defense of Mr. Page, I have pointed out to him in the past that a really good engineer is one who can do for a dollar what any fool can do for $2.
That's why I keep asking to borrow a dollar from you, Mr. McCarthy. The bullet points at the bottom get back to you. Mr. Chairman, your question comment, as well as earlier, as to what my follow-up was, is that here's the time savings between 90 and 110 miles an hour, and obviously you can see the cost differential as well. Not many minutes saved, but you know, your cost per minute certainly goes up as you get into those higher speeds. Moving along, and I promise not to derail you, no pun intended, for your 3 o'clock, Mr. Chairman, but trying to stay on schedule for you. The projected ridership, let's talk specifically about the high sides, because that's where the next series of slides are going to go for us in this document, in this presentation, is how I move forward. Just to call your attention to alternatives 1, 2A, and 2B, you'll see that for the 90 miles an hour, the ridership is pretty much flat. There's not a great increase in the scenarios. The region has a good draw for ridership. And again, we are not going to be making the decisions, I hope, on just cost, just ridership revenue alone. This will be a connectivity decision and conversation that we will have as we go through this, as to how we connect South Bank, Hampton Roads, and Newport News on the North Bank with Richmond and Points North.
And I'm sorry, about this chart about where it says status quo, I mean, that's if, just to make sure people understand, that is not what the ridership is today.
Today is the two trains, 262,300. That exists at 79 miles an hour.
Okay.
That is today's ridership.
You will find that under the no action, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, it goes to 464.8 because we're adding another train frequency. Remember, we start with 2, we go to 3, and then at the baseline, which is no action at 3, we have 2 today. With Amtrak having proposed the third train frequency, as we move through this document, we felt like we would have the third train frequency sooner than later, so that became our baseline no action of the alternatives.
Do you have data as to where are those people starting and ending?
Yes.
We have
a license plate survey. Now, as for the existing ridership, where that draw comes from, I will have to check with Amtrak because they treat that very proprietary on the 262.3. What you will find is that many of the riders come from the South Bank. They come across either the transit bus. There is a transit bus connection that Amtrak provides, the motor coach bus. And also what we find is that people drive over and get dropped off. So where are they going
and where are they staying within Virginia? Are they commuting?
Most people go north into the northeast corridor. As we found with all of our ridership estimates with both our existing Lynchburg train and also the one in Richmond coming up, we've been able to see where the riders are going, especially with the Lynchburg train. And typically over half, maybe 55-60+% actually go into the northeast corridor. So this is all about connectivity of a region to the northeast. And our ridership draw, as we developed for the alternatives, 1A, 2A, and 2B, we went all the way as far south as Charlotte, North Carolina, with hopes that the southeast corridor would be built, because that's the logical termini right now of the southeast corridor. And we go all the way up to as far north as Boston, Massachusetts, in the northeast corridor. So as we developed this ridership scenario, we developed it under the same premise that is playing out in real time today. We are proving this model with the Lynchburg train. It said we would have over 60% running into the corridor, and we are having over 60% of people riding in and out of the northeast corridor on that train. So the short of the long answer is the people are either going to DC points north.
So I'm sorry, the definition of Northeast Corridor is?
Begins Washington, D.C. to Boston, Massachusetts. If you ever ride, it's anything under the wire.
But still 40% of the people are going up to D.C.
Right,
in Northern Virginia. Within the state.
Yes, yes. So we do have a significant level of people who do, shall we use the term, commute back and forth to Washington, sometimes on a daily basis. I ride the train regularly from Richmond to Washington, and you'd be surprised there's an entire group of people that just huddle in mass and associate on the train between Richmond and Washington. I see them every time I ride. I can count on seeing those patrons.
And how do we encourage them? I'll be meeting with you all.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
Sorry.
No problem. Thank you for the question. Estimated capital costs. These next two slides roll into the third slide, which is cost effectiveness. So that's where you take the number of riderships, estimated capital costs, the revenues, operating costs, and you roll them all up into what we call the effectiveness of the operation. The estimated capital costs, as you can see for Alternative 1, and remember Alternative 1 is high-speed South Bank, conventional North Bank, no additional trains. There's $475.4 million for the 90-mile-an-hour service and $543 million for the 110-mile-an-hour service. Now, I want to point out again to you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the board, incorporated in that number is $148.9 million of costs between Richmond and Petersburg. Now, that cost is included in this document because, again, we want connectivity from Richmond, Virginia, to Norfolk on this alternative. For us not to include the cost, we would have what's called an inoperable segment between Richmond and Petersburg that we would be making an assumption that would be built as part of the Raleigh project. So that is a point I would like to make to you all, is that incorporated in that $475.4 million and the $543 million, it's $148.9 million of improvements necessary to get from Richmond to Petersburg.
Yes,
I'd point that out. That's a very big political issue, particularly on the south side of Hampton Roads, because many people say that's skewing the decision between the alternatives by including that cost. So a couple of the mayors on the south side have made that a very vocal political issue in saying that the state is somehow not fairly presented the two cost alternatives. So
I would reiterate what Mr. Page said, in that they think they're double counting monies.
I'm sorry, explain that to me again. How are we double counting? Because we need to make that improvement,
right,
regardless.
I think the challenge that the Hampton Roads, South Hampton Roads region is having with this alternative scenario, that's going to be alternative one.
Which they support, right?
Yes.
Okay.
They support, but, you know, it's very similar to doing negotiations with a private company. They support a memorandum of understanding, but they have a few other things they want to talk about. The challenge is we have a plan, a Tier 2 environmental document, which this board will become more familiar with when it's published. But we have a plan we're working on with North Carolina called the Southeast High-Speed Rail Corridor, Richmond to Raleigh, Tier 2 environmental impact statement. That impact statement brings us to the next level of engineering and includes the costs of how to develop high-speed rail, not higher speed rail, but high-speed rail between Richmond and Raleigh. Under this proposal that I just went through, the inclusion of the $148.9 million on this proposal provides a what they call a logical termini endpoint to endpoint plan. Remember, we're developing passenger rail system here. Richmond, Petersburg, Norfolk. The logical termini is Norfolk and Main Street Station, Richmond. That's what we advertised in 2004. Those were the logical termini of the study. The challenge that the South Bank is having is they do not want the $148.9 million as part of the cost to go to Norfolk. But for this planning document to have what we refer to as independent utility, a fair assessment between Richmond and Newport News, and also the ability to operate a train from Main Street Station, Richmond to Norfolk, in the absence of the Raleigh connection being made, we have to include this in this document. That $148.9 million.
I'm sorry, why is the cost that high for that one segment? What is happening in there?
The challenge is from Richmond to Centralia is an industrial lead railroad. It's a railroad that has not seen a passenger train since 1968. And it's a relatively industrial line of CSXs. There has to be improvements made there. In addition to that, we're following the old route of the Atlantic coastline, which is CSX's busiest corridor. We need to put a third track in, very similar to what our program is from Richmond to Washington. That's your challenge. We get to the Appomattox River. It's a single-track bridge. We need to also address that as well. So there are some challenges for operability between Richmond and Petersburg to add that capacity as we move forward, and we felt that it's appropriate to add those costs, but also footnote those costs by saying we feel that we're being as responsible as we can, being the rail agency, to develop a plan and process that provides connectivity to a region in a planning process that doesn't leave us with 25 miles of inoperability between Petersburg and Richmond.
If I may, the bottom line is that if you're comparing the south side and the peninsula, exclusive of Petersburg to Richmond, they're relatively similar in cost.
Right.
But if you add the Petersburg to Richmond, it's $148 million more expensive,
right,
which, if you're looking at the numbers, makes it look like the less desirable route, which, in fact, it is not because of a lot of reasons, cost being one of them, but the MPO, the TPO, has supported that alternative one. And the argument that we're getting is trying to make the two sides comparable, which I think is not really an important argument for us to be concerned about, because of the we understand the impact of that the Petersburg to Richmond has to be built in order for the line to go south, so therefore it should not be considered a part of the...
Right. It should not be discounted from this plan. Otherwise, we have taken the opportunity for this project to be developed sooner than later, because we would have to wait then for Raleigh to be built in order for us to connect to Norfolk.
And beyond doing this phase two of the environmental review there, where is that plan, the Raleigh to Richmond?
Raleigh to Richmond, as I went through earlier with the $8 billion, and Mr. Dickens was very good to comment about the over $100 billion worth of applications. North Carolina DOT has already submitted application under the ARRA stimulus program, the $8 billion program, for funding to build the line from Richmond South.
I'm sorry, so did we include it in our application, or did they include it in their application?
They included it in their application. In our application, we only had conventional rail improvements from Centralia, Virginia, which is in Chesterfield County, to Main Street Station. As I kind of gave an overview a little bit earlier, our plan is to bring connectivity of all the trains to downtown Richmond, conventional trains, and then go to a higher speed north of Richmond, which would start at Staples Mill Station.
So we should be supporting the North Carolina plan and our own plan.
Right. In the order of priority and magnitude, I think we should concentrate on Virginia and then go to North Carolina, sir.
The governor's from Virginia down there, sir.
Yeah.
He's from Grundy.
Everybody. Everyone's from Virginia.
At the same time, though, for Mr. Keene, Mr. Secretary, if I may, we are moving forward with the Lynchburg train and obviously plans to extend further west. So we are still being very cognizant that Virginia's a wide state. Okay, thank you. I'll move on to estimated operating costs. As you can see, under alternative one, the costs are obviously including the $21.3 million of the existing CSX route to Newport News. Someone asked me the other day, says, well, why don't you just run to Norfolk and not Newport News at all? Because none of our scenarios actually provided Newport News no service. Well, one of the challenges is that Amtrak, part of their original system back in 1970-71, when the National Rail Passenger Act was passed and Amtrak was created, that's part of their original system. So in order for Amtrak to leave Newport News, obviously it would have to abandon part of its original system. And we felt that we still needed to keep that connectivity to provide services to on an existing route as well. Let's see, cost effectiveness, as I mentioned earlier, the two slides, estimated capital cost and estimated operating cost, get rolled into what's called cost effectiveness. This is what we use kind of as an indicator to say, well, what are the annualized costs per rider? That's capital and also the additional operating and services and maintenance costs of the trains. And we divide all of that by the high ridership estimate that I kind of called your attention to earlier that we were running across the board. As you can see here, alternative one has $106.03, $121 for alternative A, and $88 for alternative B. Well, alternative B, as you may recall, all trains stayed on the North Bank. We had one new station, but we abandoned the station. We relocated Newport News in doing that. So that's where you can see where the cost savings is. As for connectivity between alternative one and 2A, alternative one had the three trains that currently exist today, I mean the two trains plus the additional one that exists in that corridor today to Newport News, and the Southside High Speed Rail corridor is where the additional cost came in at $106 total. So of the two alternatives that provide connectivity to the Southern Hampton Roads Bank, obviously alternative one is the most cost effective of the two.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I'm sorry, but now I am confused a little bit, and I guess my simplest question would be, can you tell us why people prefer alternative 1 to alternative 2B, for example?
Alternative,
there's something
about right.
having service on the south side of the James River that's important? Or
yes. Draw your attention back to the graphic, or I think there might have been a board comment. I'm sorry, didn't you cut across?
No,
go ahead.
Well, the issue is there's two-thirds of the population of Hampton Roads are on the south side. There's existing service on the peninsula. You got two trains currently. The higher speed is not as important there because of the shortness of the distance between Newport News and Richmond. Also, the difficulty in the curves in the track. Curves probably not the proper term there. But there's no existing service on the south side. You got that straight shot between Petersburg and Suffolk that makes high speed a lot more practical, a lot more doable there. And on the peninsula, the issues are more on time and frequency than the length of time it takes to make the trip.
Right. Thank you, Dana. The real reason I couldn't quite grasp it was, at least the map that we have, it wasn't clear to me
whether it actually went over to Norfolk, and clearly it does not.
Does not. And the Navy base is
in the story.
Yes. Right.
And there was no, and you were discussing that earlier.
As a dismissed alternative.
Because
right.
You think it's too expensive.
Yes. It's an extra $500 million.
Half a billion?
To cross $500 million is what we have.
Oh, gosh, we do that.
That'd be the cheapest possible.
Look under your chair.
I'm sorry, $500 million to do which piece?
It was a 4.4-mile structure, aerial structure with a lift-in, lift-bridge.
I'm sorry, sir.
It was a lift-bridge structure. It was not a tunnel. It went across the river near the U.S. 17 crossing there at Hibernate.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm sorry. I thought you were talking about down to the
Navy. No, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. We had two conversations going. Sorry, Mr. Chairman. We had the alternative consider.
So you can't go across the harbor area?
The Elizabeth. You're talking about the Elizabeth route.
We do cross the Elizabeth River on the old Virginian drawbridge alignment, which is south of Berkeley.
I guess what I'm asking is, where do you guys want this to come into in Norfolk?
Well, see, part of the to finish my comments, the light rail system that's in being started in Norfolk is on the south side. The higher speed rail line will come in at Harbor Park there in downtown Norfolk and connect in with the light rail system, which goes to the military in the north and to the beach. Great assets for those areas.
Plus, politically, if I may, this is the first time that our region has come together on a transportation project where they've got ahead of it and said, as a group, that they've supported one alternative. I mean, so that is 1A. That's the first time historic for Hampton Roads. I know it may not be so in other parts of the state, but Hampton Roads. So they are politically aligned, which has been an issue in the past with many projects at Hampton Roads.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, I want to call your attention just back to the time and distance slide here. One of the other drivers here is to draw your attention to downtown Norfolk at 90 miles per hour, is an hour and 35 minutes. If we stay conventional, back to the question about why alternative one, if you stay conventional to New Pernes, you're still an hour and 25 minutes. So it's a 10-minute differential by running the train faster at 90 miles an hour. And obviously the hour and 38 minutes is probably achievable at a conventional speed, but the 90 miles per hour will give you greater reliability for train conflicts and overtakes.
Yes.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Kevin, what assumption are you making both on the northern and the southern part of this as to the frequency and location of stations along the way?
Well, that's a very good question, and thank you, Mr. Schwartz, for asking. We did a stations alternatives analysis. We looked at, from Richmond, Virginia here, from Main Street, we looked at a downtown location, obviously. We looked at the International Airport, the location, but dismissed it due to the fact of where the railroad and the new 895 connector come in. We just didn't have the space to do it. In addition to that, we also looked down towards Providence Forge. We looked at another station location at Bland Boulevard, which is Oyster Point, which is near the Newport News, the airport at Newport News, as well as continuing with the existing alignment station at Newport News or a new station downtown. And that's what you find under the higher speed scenario on Newport News is downtown. So we do downtown, Williamsburg, Richmond were the alternatives that we ended up with station locations. On the South Bank, we had obviously Main Street Station, Petersburg. We looked at some intermediate stops along the way, but dismissed those because of the population centers. You know, we just didn't have the population draw. But we ended up at Bowers Hill, which is a very close proximity location where the 64s, I call them, and 58 come together along with 460. So it's kind of an apex of transportation facilities come into one place. And that was the value that we found with Bowers Hill, was the connectivity to both the road systems and the rail system, and gets back to the reutilization of the old Virginian right-of-way, because that's very close to where that intersection is at Bowers Hill. So you come literally right off onto 58, 460, and you drop right into the Bowers Hill station off of the 64s, so to speak. Then downtown, we looked at some sites downtown and ended up at Harbor Park, because as the Hampton Roads representatives have been very clear to point out, Again, it's about connectivity. We're connecting to not only HRT's Tide line, but also their bus line there at the Harbor Station, as well as the fact that that's where NS's rail line comes across the channel there, the Elizabeth River, right out to the very central location as to how we get to other transportation facilities.
John, I have a question.
Yes.
Kevin, what I've heard you say is the cost just to come across the James River is $500 million.
Right.
Your alternative one, which gives better service on the peninsula and high-speed rail into Norfolk through Petersburg, is $475 million. So we get to serve both population centers at much less money.
And the city of Petersburg.
And the city of Petersburg.
Yes, ma'am.
So the numbers work so much better in what you've proposed an alternative.
Right. For cost effectiveness, and again, we're talking about connecting the Commonwealth, and I think that's what you made in your comments earlier, what Director Drake mentioned was, is, you know, we're about connectivity here, as well as trying to find a way to set a system. And we felt that was probably the most responsible approach to take was to bring forward a strategy where we could serve the highest populations of Virginia as we could with the amount of funding that we were coming forward in the proposal. Okay, any other questions before we talk about the environment for a few minutes?
Chairman?
Yes.
Mr. Page, if you were making this decision yourself, which alternative would you pick?
Well, I don't want to preempt the decision process, Mr. Bowie, but I certainly think that if you fall back, that alternative one sets forward a strategy where we can provide connectivity to, as has been mentioned earlier, two-thirds of the population of the region. I have met and spoken with both the tech committee and the HRTPO now three times, and I've emphasized that. We're talking about building a transportation system of connectivity where we can provide the highest and best use of our limited resources and provide both North and South Bank services, and Alternative 1 does that for the best funding alternative. But I'm not making that as a recommendation to the board because we are here to obviously brief the board today and then hear what the public has to say, and we're going to come back to see you in February at your February board meeting and present this out for you, Mr. Bowie, and you'll probably see that things will head in that direction.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Kevin, on Alternative 1, does the alternative itself presents some future problems with impediment of the train scheduling because of the double utility between Richmond and Petersburg?
Between Richmond and Petersburg, the reason why we put the, you know, included that $148 million under Alternative 1 was so that we could have the track capacity where we could run the trains. Otherwise, without that $148 million worth of improvements, we'd probably come to closure very quickly with Norfolk Southern as to how we can move those trains. But we would probably be having to set up a temporary station in Petersburg because we wouldn't really have the capacity to run on CSX. So it's a strong negotiation process with private railroad companies, but we've been able to come together with our framework agreement as to how we go through that process and get to those terms.
Ms. Frank.
I think part of that question is, when the train comes from Raleigh to Richmond, is there another track built, or can they use this track?
The same track. I'm sorry, Mr. Keene, if that
so
was
So it
your
really,
question.
Yes. If that could be built quickly, it reduces that 475 by the 148. I mean,
right.
We aren't going to have to build it again. We're only going to build it.
Exactly.
That was my understanding.
Yes, ma'am. That's
I wanted
correct.
To be clear.
That is correct. There is overlap, and you are correct. What that does is it brings down Alternative 1 to $326,500,000.
Which is the same cost as the lower.
Yeah, right.
Just to upgrade the
So, like with the ridership, we have an alternative scenario, North Bank, South Bank, that's very close. However, we had to include that $148 million because of the lack of the Southeast Corridor. We don't want to set forward a plan that requires another plan and implementation to get there. We want to, you know, we've been able to be very successful in Virginia at initiating new passenger rail services inside the Commonwealth. We wanted this to have the connectivity inside the Commonwealth without an inoperable segment that required us to go out of state to Raleigh before we get there. Okay. Any other questions? So before we talk about environmental considerations for a few minutes?
A quick follow-up on the cost.
Sure.
If the Raleigh line is built, I mean, in other words, if that's one, we'll take the $148 million out of our numbers. In other words, we're only going to build it once. That,
right.
And that keeps
right.
coming up over and over down there is where does the $148 million go to?
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, if they don't get funded and we do it, when they submit their proposal, they won't have the $148 million because we'll have done it. Right. But that seems not to be getting through to many of the people in Hampton Roads. Just to, and it's I can't tell you how politically
right.
it's been batted around and in the process down there. So I just want to point that out.
And I believe, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, thank you, Mr. Lane, for reemphasizing that. We are going to have representatives from the Federal Railroad Administration with us at the public meetings. So they will be able to hear this, and hopefully I will work with them to help clarify that, because at the federal level, they made the same decision on the record of decision to Raleigh from Richmond as they are. It's the same group of people making the decision to Norfolk and Newport News. So I'll work with Director Drake to make sure that we have the Fed queued up for that discussion.
Sometimes you kind of wonder, I mean, I think we should all be more cognizant, more focused on trying to get the money to begin with versus trying to ask questions as to what happens to the money that we don't have.
Right. Okay, I'm going to transition just for a few minutes into environmental considerations, then we're going to come back to the public meetings and the information process. I couldn't have this presentation without explaining to you all, this is an environmental impact statement, so obviously we have considerable considerations we have to give the environment based under NEPA. In addition to that, we looked at the sidings, passing sidings for trains, additional rights of way necessary, reuse of existing, retired rights of way as well. And then we also talked about, the impacts that may result from, our new passenger rail service. You have horn blowing at grade crossings and increased speeds for passenger rail service, increased frequencies of passenger rail service as well. So all of that got rolled into the next several slides that we'll break down by scenario. Obviously, the status quo and no action, those are environmental, since baseline was no action, there are no environmental considerations, obviously, under these alternatives because they already, our baseline has them as existing today. So this slide is basically just to show you under the status quo and no action, which again, no action is the baseline, that there are no potential impacts. Under the effects under alternative one, as you can see, we've kind of drawn out the impacts as to whether they support the limit or support highway congestion, probable air impacts, wetland considerations. Obviously, as I mentioned earlier, we go through the Chickahominy Swamp on one route and the Dismal Swamp on another route, and we also get into the Blackwater River area as well on the Norfolk route. So as you run through that, you're going to find that alternative one has an overall rating of, it either supports or it has some severe impacts in floodland areas, obviously it's a tidal basin and has the swamp areas, as well as the probable noise impacts because we are increasing train service under alternative one to the Norfolk line from Petersburg as well. And then, of course, probable vibration had to be measured as well. Alternative 2A, as we move forward, has similar, considerations as you can see. And again, 1 and 2A, we're basically just flipping. We have the same number of trains running overall comparatively in the north and south banks as a total. And we are also adding new service just like we were on the other alternative to Norfolk, except we're under 2A. It's conventional rail instead of high-speed rail. 2B is all north bank only. You're going to see a little adjustment there because of the fact that, we're dealing with just the north bank. It already has train service today, and there will be no impacts, obviously, from Petersburg to Norfolk under this scenario. I want to talk just a little bit, if I may, because we are kicking off today, and this briefing that you've seen today is very similar to the one that we will be giving in our public meetings that are coming up on the 26th, 27th, and 28th of this month. The 26th, we will be in Richmond. The 27th, we will be in Newport News, and the 28th, we will be in Norfolk, conducting public meetings very similar, as you see the photograph here, as we had some of our outreach sessions as went on early in the process as to when we move forward. I mentioned earlier about the technical working group. This was the working group that helped advise us through this process from the two meetings we had initially back in 2004 and late 2003, early 2004 as we started this process all the way through until we actually started crafting and drafting the document. We did have a speakers bureau that went around very similarly. I mentioned I've been down to the HRTPO now on three different occasions. Recently, Chip Badger went once as well. We also printed newsletters, fact sheets. Again, we're holding the public information meetings I just talked about. as well as we've maintained our project website and also done mass mailings and postcards and surveys as well as advertisements in the local media and also work through the media contacts that we've had through the newspaper inquiries. A couple of key findings I want to kind of, you know, I know we've gone over some of these, we just want to reemphasize today. The status quo no action alternatives did not meet the purpose and need. Remember, the purpose and need is we want to enhance passenger rail to the region and also lead to the higher and high-speed rail, the 90 and the 110-mile-an-hour rail. 90 miles per hour is the optimum higher speed. Remember, as I talked about earlier, time, distance, and what it takes to get to that next level. The build alternatives, alternatives 1 and 2A serve the greatest population base with the trains on both routes, as I mentioned earlier, as well as our representatives from Richmond and in the Hampton Roads region. Alternatives 1 and 2A provide that service to Southside. Remember, we're 2/3 of the population. Alternatives 1 and 2A have the highest ridership, as I mentioned earlier, as well as Alternative 2B has the lowest capital and operating costs and obviously the environmental as well, as I went through just a minute ago, because we're obviously staying on the North Bank. It's also most cost-effective. Again, we're running on a train system on a line that with improvements exists today with train service, passenger rail service. Alternative 2B has the least potential for negative environmental impacts. I mentioned earlier, just to reiterate, that this is an environmental document. And it's primarily within the route's existing rights-of-way. So it's very strong to point out that, you know, Alternative 2B, as Mr. Lane mentioned earlier, it's a pretty circuitous route and will require limited areas where we can actually achieve higher speeds in that distance of 75 miles.
Ms. Panther?
Mr. Chairman, with respect to this page, with respect to Alternative 1, where the potential impacts show potentially severe impacts, the EIS will identify those impacts at a later point. If that alternative were to be selected, then those impacts need to be mitigated, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
And those mitigation processes are not in the EIS, are they?
That is, your assumption is correct. This is this draft document is a tier one level environmental review, which we, on a very high level, identify the potential impacts. The next level is very similar to what I reviewed with you all earlier about the Tier 2 environmental impact statement we're doing with North Carolina DOT between Richmond and Raleigh. Tier 2 is the next step as to how we more further refine, make those critical decisions on train stations, environmental impacts, identify them, and how they can be mitigated engineeringly. And that's where it's going to take someone with a PE at the end of their name to assist us in engineering through some of those solutions.
And the cost estimates that you have used, do those anticipate some of the environmental impacts,
The answer is yes, they do at a high level. Obviously, as we all know, there has to be a more granular review of environmental impacts as we move forward. One of the good parts of this is I want to emphasize to the board, at 90 miles an hour, remember, we're using existing rights-of-way, which means if you build a third track, you have the ability to use all three of those tracks, instead of having to go out and build a double-track railroad or a single-track railroad with passing sidings to achieve that 110.
Mr. Chairman, on the question of the costs, when you do get to the more detailed environmental analysis, I mean, the whole point of that is to inform the decision-making about whether A, B, C, or D makes the most sense when you add it all up.
Right.
So if we followed your guess about the future, and Alternative 1 might wind up being the preferred alternative among several, it also has these potentially severe impacts, I see on the chart, and those have to be mitigated in some fashion at some cost, or the costs are too high, they can't be mitigated, they run into political problems, who knows, and then you have to rewind and figure out the system. That doesn't happen yet? That doesn't happen
to Tier 2? That is Tier 2. And if we find that we have a section that cannot be mitigated under the Tier 2 process, we can go back and do further study that either adjusts the alignment, Mr. McCarthy, or it takes us to another alignment altogether. And that's the Tier 2 part of this, as to how we further refine that. Our Tier 1 level document assumed that we were going to use the existing right-of-way from Petersburg all the way to Norlina, which is the old gravel roadbed. And under our Tier 2 document, we actually came out, we're stepping off of that alignment in a few places to straighten out curves, for example, and swing around a few wet areas. So to answer your question, the Tier 2 level of analysis is where we then get to the more granular and more defined a position of that.
On Petersburg to wherever, before you get into Norfolk.
Right.
Is that track that's there that parallels 460 right now, is that what you're talking about?
The track that parallels 460 is the track that we're talking about. When you get on 460 and you drive straight for many miles, that is the piece of railroad.
Thanks.
Thank you. Okay, I want to just give an overview of next steps if there are no other questions before we move on. Mr. Chairman, do you have any other questions? Or?
No, it's okay, Mr. Page.
All right, okay. Thank you. We will come back to this board. Our public comment period ends on February the 11th. We're coming back to the Commonwealth Transportation Board. We will brief you all on the regional input, the input of the citizens, and also what we would consider to be a recommendation coming from the department as to what we feel is a preferred alternative for consideration and action of the Commonwealth Transportation Board. Once this alternative is acted upon, it will be transmitted as part of the fully developed document to the Federal Railroad Administration as to how we move forward and request with them of what's called a record of decision on what alignment that they would consider to be the preferred alternative. We will also move forward if there is a round two, track two era stimulus funding application, which we have not heard from the Fed that there is not going to be one. We will advance for a round two, track two application as to how we take this quarter study and construction to the next level of the preferred alternative. During that process, like I mentioned, we are going to submit to the Fed the final EIS, the FEIS is the acronym, to the FRA, and also the FRA will issue a record of decision based on that as we move forward. Mr. Chairman, I realize that was a long and lengthy presentation, but I hope that everyone benefited from it, and I appreciate all the good questions that you all have had, because it's nice to see that this board is trying to get educated on what can be a somewhat sensitive transportation decision for the region of Hampton Roads.
Before we leave you, Mr. Page, I want to just make sure I understand one other thing. The assumption going in regarding these costs, are they based on who is operating the trains? I mean, what's the assumption going in?
Amtrak will be is a potential operator of these trains. Remember, under PREA, the legislation that was passed back in October of 2008, Amtrak was given the ability to expand their system, expand their services. And that's what got us to the extension of the passenger rail to Lynchburg and also to Richmond on the Northeast trains that we are subsidizing. But there are also other rail operators in the United States. I want to be very clear about that. But the point I want to make out to you all is that under our operating plan, we will be extending trains, as many as we can, out of Richmond. There's regional trains that Mr. McCarthy talked about earlier that don't go anywhere but Richmond. They stop at Richmond at night. They are the ones that we potentially could extend to Norfolk without having to purchase or procure additional train sets. And that's of good value to us in trying to work with that operating plan. If another operator should come to the table under a PPTA or something of that fashion, obviously I'm having to look into a crystal ball here, obviously that would change the scenario, but has potential of the train stopping at Main Street Station and not going any further north, because Amtrak certainly has the connectivity restrictions that can be applied at the Northeast Quarter on their system. So I just wanted
to... But the assumption that's embedded in the study at this point is Amtrak.
That would be it, right? Be an operator like Amtrak.
Any other questions? Yes.
First of all, I want to compliment Kevin Page and the staff for doing a wonderful job of educating me and a lot of other people about the advantages and how all this works. And Ms. Carr just asked me a question, when do we build all this stuff? And it's an excellent question. I would suggest to you that the stimulus money is critical here. That's what started a lot of this conversation. But there's a piece of it that we haven't talked about today that is extremely critical, and that is we are not eligible for FRA or stimulus money unless we have
a dedicated stream, revenue stream to fund the operating expenses, correct?
Right. Mr. Dickens, to clarify your statement, under the stimulus fund guidance, there is a corridor and service development plan that has to be submitted by the applicant, in this case it would be the Commonwealth of Virginia, that shows that there will be a sustainability and a revenue source for the subsidy of operations of trains that would be running as a result of the capital improvements.
Right. And to carry that forward, there's a study, joint study commission coming out of the Senate, sponsored by Senator Miller and Senator Watkins, that establishes a passenger rail sustainability fund. It establishes a study to establish the firm. Is that right, Kevin?
Yes.
And it also studies provides a study to determine a revenue stream to provide this operating expense. Very critical that this bill pass so that we are indeed eligible for stimulus money. I think the bill got out of the Senate, a Senate subcommittee yesterday. It's going to Senate Rules. Next time Senate Rules meets, and I don't think anybody knows when that is at this point in time. But it's important that we support that and get that bill passed, or else we're without stimulus money.
Appreciate that. Any other questions? Paige, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Before we, that's the last of the work session. I'm sorry. This is my first CTB meeting ever. Is this how we normally do work sessions? Do we ever invite in the MPOs, or now we have two transportation authorities, or for those areas don't have MPOs, the planning district, do we ever invite them in to come in and talk to us?
The MPOs have come in and made presentations during our public comment period, or when we're doing the public hearings on the six-year plan, things of that nature. They'll be represented coming in and making an actual presentation on their particular plan. In my time, I don't remember them doing it, although the district representatives often attend those meetings, and I've been to some.
No, would you all be interested if we start inviting in? I mean, obviously, everything that we do is tied into what they're doing. To bring them in, at least one or two every work session, go over their plans, figure out how many there are. I mean, obviously, the MPOs are six MPOs?
Five? I think there's more than that, Mr. Chairman. There's five big ones.
The five big ones, and then we have the two authorities, right? Hampton Roads has an authority. Right.
TPO.
They call it a TPO. It's the MPO renamed.
Okay, so they didn't actually, I thought when the legislation passed, there was an actual authority.
Oh, yeah, but that was to deal with funding that's been disbanded.
That was disbanded.
Okay, so they didn't, but Northern Virginia has a transportation authority.
That was disbanded in Hampton.
And then for the areas that don't have MPOs, do the planning districts actually handle the overall?
Regional planning districts do some planning toward it.
So what I'm thinking about doing is maybe we'll invite in at least, since it's 14?
14.
Yes. 14, we'll bring in so at least one, and we'll have a couple at one meeting, so at least once a year we hear from every one of them to go over their plans and their suggestions to us. Is everyone okay with it? Yes, Ms. Davis.
I had another topic here.
Sure.
We spent quite a bit of time the last few months on V-Trans, trying to look at what we thought would happen down the road for transportation in the Commonwealth, and it's really interesting to hear the conversations about the most cost-effective or possible thing. It's entirely another matter to talk about what ought to be done for the long-term economic viability and quality of life of the Commonwealth. We spent a little time talking about that, about the role of rail. And obviously it requires the assumption that we're not going to depend totally on federal funds if we're going to do it, because what's in the interest of the Commonwealth of Virginia may or may not be in the interest of the federal government. And I like to see some effort at some balance in that view as we talk about things. I think it was very helpful today to hear this very specific presentation after having spent a couple of months debating a little bit, what should we do about freight rail in Virginia?
Mm-hmm.
And what should we do about passenger rail in Virginia? And it's a different story. It's almost like two different views to talk about what ought to be done and what might be possible using federal stimulus money. And I hope we won't forget that we need to try to merge those two conversations as we talk about this.
Well, maybe kind of build on, all right, in addition to the MPOs, Transportation Authority, and some of the planning districts, I would maybe like to try to bring in both Class 1s. I'd like to talk about freight mobility, which is obviously within, and then I wouldn't mind actually bringing our friends from Amtrak directly in at some point, Metro. I personally would like to turn these sessions into a little bit more of a dialogue so we can start to get a little bit better grip on what's going on generally, and so we can be a little bit more informed about some of our decisions. I mean, just more to say, have a broader view out there. I would like to hear from the Class 1s who are also out there acting on freight mobility issues, where there's a lot of federal interface with that. And then any other ideas you'd like to have and who you'd like to hear from?
BRE.
Would, what's that?
BRE.
And BRE? The, because, again, I would like to use this as an opportunity for us not only just to go over some of the bigger studies that we're doing, some of the, and B-Trans and some of the other plans that we're actually doing, but let's start hearing directly from some of the people that were actually out there doing a lot of this. You know, some of it, I'm not saying that's not independent, but all these parts, it's like a puzzle.
It's all interrelated in a way, because when we talk about the problems of Interstate 81 and the possible solutions, rail diversion obviously has always been a very important part of that conversation. Yet to do real rail diversion along 81 requires a different conversation than we're having if we're to ever really successfully have the kind of impact that's needed. The same is true in a way. We talked about passenger rail coming out of Hampton Roads. Freight rail across the south side of Virginia to West Virginia and on the Heartland Corridor is also a huge issue. And I think somehow or another we just have to take that bigger view and match it with seeking federal money, but also keep before the Commonwealth the conversation, if you want us to be the kind of economic engine state that we've been for the last 20 years, this kind of investment is going to have to be made, so let's figure out how we're going to do it.
Mr. Secretary, and since this is my first meeting, I don't know if you've done this or not, but I do expect that the transportation bill will be taken up this year in Washington. I know I believe, and I know you believe, that there'll be additional money in that transportation bill for rail and that we need to be very engaged with that. But I wonder, is there ever a discussion within the CTB as to what Virginia is asking for in that transportation bill? Because I didn't see that in 2005. And I've asked along the way, could there be more of a coordinated effort of what would we like to do from the federal level? How do we maximize that money? How do we have a transportation system where we're using all of your congressional delegation instead of just one city wants a little piece of this road and one city wants a new interstate ramp? How do you maximize that federal money? Maybe you've done that, but I didn't see it in 2005, and I just think that's an opportunity that, now it may not happen until next year, but at least we would be prepared, but I expect it'll happen this year because it's already a year late and Chairman Oberstar is very anxious to get it going.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Great. With respect to the stimulus money, the $700 million, there definitely was an effort made to speak with every member of the congressional delegation this year. I was part of that. I met with three of them myself, four of them, and that was the first time I think any board members more or less formally got involved in doing that, and I think there's a pretty good idea embedded in that question, because they were all delighted to be asked, and they all followed through with either phone calls or letters or both to the secretary
to make sure that their views were presented. It's one of the reasons why we took a little bit of criticism last year about we took a little longer than some other states to get going on this, and the reason is we actually consulted extensively, and especially with the congressional delegation, and as a result, we did get things done on time, and we think we got them done better than they might have been done if we just sat around the table and said, well, let's follow whatever VDOT wants to do. And so I think we got a better result by doing that kind of a process, and it would be kind of interesting to see how it might work going forward, I would say.
I guess, you know, so what we'll do is start off by let's bring down our leader of our legislative office up in Washington and have her come down and do a presentation about where the authorization bill is. Yes?
Would allow me, Mr. Secretary, this has been one of the best meetings that I've attended for a long time because I've been educated. A lot of this is where we miss out, that we don't have enough discussion and we do not have work sessions, only what we have here. And sometimes we rush through those the day we have it. And also your idea of bringing the MPOs in to speak to the Commonwealth Transportation Board is certainly a positive. I have attended the MPOs in my region, the Fredericksburg District. And you find one locality going this way, another locality going this way, another locality going this way. Okay. So I sat there and many times I said, you guys need to come together, and girls, whatever. And you all need to come together. If we don't come together, we're not going to get anything. And sometimes that will happen. And it did happen recently, and thank goodness we got the stimulus funding and whatever. But knowing that they're going to come before the CTB, I think that will bring them into focus more than, you know, hey guys, we better have it together when we go. Because we're going and we're going to present this before the CTB. Not to sit here and discuss who's going to get this funding, who's going to get this funding. We need to come together. I think it's a terrific idea.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Listen, we can just make sure this gets reflected in the minutes, and we'll work out a schedule. Make sure that every year we start up a schedule in the next 12 months, every MPO, we bring them in. We bring in the transportation authorities. We bring in those areas that don't have either to get get the Regional Planning Commission reps in. I'd like to bring in the Class 1 railroads and talk about freight mobility. I think it's important we bring the airports in. And I don't know how, MWA could be a start, but also let's talk to our other larger airports, try to bring them in. They realize it doesn't come under us directly, but these are major drivers for transportation. I'd like to bring in the Port Authority.
Oh, absolutely.
I'm always amazed. In fact, just recently came up, but for my own self, people don't think about the fact that when we point to a couple, 4 or 5 million TEUs going in and out of that port every year, they seem to forget that those are 4 or 5 million boxes that go on our highways or rail. And I think it's important to hear what's happening at the port and what their plans are, because it's going to impact our transportation functions here. I think I'd like to bring in WMATA, and I think I'd like to also bring in your Hampton Roads Transit, and then we can start to bring in some of the other transit administrations as well, authorities, so we can start to get a better feel for what they're doing. BRE, and we'll develop a list, but I would like to maybe start to use these work sessions much more of a dialogue with the folks that are directly impacted by the CTB's decisions, make sure we're not making these decisions in isolation, and vice versa. Okay?
Mr. Chairman.
And again, I'm sorry, then bring in the head of our Washington office. Let's get her down here at the next meeting or so to talk about the transportation reauthorization, what's going on. Yes, Mr. Coleman.
Mr. Chairman, I think you're on the right track here. Our discussions about our own VTrans plan convinced many of us that going forward, the system is much more volatile than it's been. The revenue sources never quite settle back down into predictability that we have built a system on. It's not just a formal coordination role that the CTB has. It's a very broad leadership role. And whether we have authority over an MPO or vice versa isn't really the question. The question is who is possessing the whole understanding of the system we're trying to both modernize and operate on a daily basis. And that's a powerful role, even if it's not officially given to any one of those bodies that you were just mentioning. So I think each of us is hungry for that, to understand, particularly in a time of revenue constraints, how it is that we can best put dollars on the margin to actually further system integration, system performance, system modernization. And, you know, they say an outgoing engineer is one that stares at your shoes. Which, for us,
these engineers are expensive and they don't do anything. Is that what you're talking
about? It's our ability to actually see beyond our immediate business that helps us have the perspective to understand at the fullest sense the system that we're trying to build and operate.
Yes,
I'd just like to reiterate what Ms. Colomay and Ms. Carter said. I've been doing this 7 months and I've never seen a more bifurcated misinformation system of trying to pull things together. And so I think it is an excellent idea to have these groups come before us, at least in terms of us being coordinated, because that's what I've spent most of my time on, is just trying to get the right information in the decision makers' hands.
Yeah. Well, and listen, there's a method to my madness. I mean, I've sat on the Washington TPP, and I'm always amazed that, VDOT, Virginia had a rep, but it wasn't always the person knew of what the CTB was doing. We got to coordinate better. We got to pull our plans in together. And you know, we've got to reestablish our leadership role. Okay? And that's what we're going to start doing. Well, listen, we will have start, and we're going to play around a little bit with the schedules and stuff, because I'd like to make this a little bit more robust in the future. Okay. With that, why don't we take like a 5 minute break?
That's great.
And we'll kick back in at 2:30, if that's all right. Just 5 minutes. Give everybody a stretch your legs. What's that? This is the work session. Work sessions are actually okay. So we're going to adjourn the work session. Start in 5 minutes.
about.
Right. That's what the questions are. Well, number, the only money we've got so far at the state is on this project, and the TPO is Raymond Hampton Roads Bridge. That's a region having to come together.
I wrote a letter
Thank you.
I'll see you. All right, we ready to go?
Yeah.
We have our guess our board members rejoin us. Let's see, do we have a quorum? What's a quorum? What's a quorum for this board?
Carol will tell you.
Carol, what's a quorum?
It used to be a Pierce Homer.
It's cool, Meg. And hey, nice. We'll wait for the rest of the board members. We got one more coming. How many more we got?
One.
Okay, if we can hand out the copies of the resolution.
Yes, in just a moment.
Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to welcome you all to this afternoon's meeting of the Commonwealth Transportation Board and its action agenda. Before we start with the published agenda, I'd like to, I think there's a desire to amend the agenda to take action on this resolution that's before the board. Can I have a motion to amend the agenda to include?
No, Chair.
Second,
yeah.
All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Thank you very much. So we will be taking a vote on this resolution. It's probably going to be in about 20 or 25 minutes. So thank you all very much. At this point, I am going to ask you, if nobody has signed up to make any public comments, is there anyone in the audience who would like to say a few words? Excellent. We will now move on from that. We have the minutes of December 17, 2009. Has everyone had an opportunity to take a look at it? Anyone have any changes they would like to make to it?
Move approved.
Second.
All those, any comments? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Okay, the ayes have it. Next is the maintenance division. We have Connie Sorrell.
Mr. Secretary, just as a way of introduction to you to this part of the board meeting, these are typically actions you may be very familiar with them, having been a member of the Board of Supervisors, where construction projects cause sections of road to be either abandoned or discontinued in bits and pieces as we change realignments and those sorts of things. So typically the board has a number of these actions that they're required by the Code of Virginia to take. They're pretty perfunctory. And as you can see, there's a list of them in Bristol District, Richmond, and Northern Virginia. And so usually the board votes on these in a block. And if there are any questions about any of them, I'd be happy to answer them.
Are there any questions?
Move the approval.
Oh, wait, Mr. Bowie, I'm sorry. I'm going to change how we do things a little bit.
Okay? Yeah, well, that's why I did that brief introduction.
I'd like to go through. I mean, when we have our different districts, I'm going to ask, go to turn to that member from that district to make that motion. And that's how I want to break it up.
Okay, excellent. Okay.
Mr. Bowie, so I'm going to ask you to make the motion on the matters within your district.
Move the approval. The matters in Lee County.
Do you have any seconds?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Thank you very much. Richmond District, that is Ms. Mr. McCarthy is the Richmond District. So move, Mr. McCarthy. I have a second?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Okay. None opposed? Bristol District?
Move the approval.
Second. Let me second.
Oops. All those, I'm sorry, you know what, well, in the future we're going to combine these, because what I'd like to do in the future is we'll do it by district, and that way we'll make sure the member from that
district. So all the discontinuances and abandonments will all be grouped by district. I can make sure that happens in the next meeting. Thank you.
Excellent.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. So we have a motion, we have a second, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. We have none opposed. We have Northern Virginia District.
Mr. Chairman, I move the discontinuances from primary system, secondary system, and transfers to secondary system for the Northern Virginia District be approved.
Cool. Thank you very much. We have a second.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Thank you very much. And I'm sorry I had to come back to, again, the Bristol District on the transfer of the secondary system.
Move to approve the transfers.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Thank you very much. All right, I'm sorry, Nelson County, this...
Yes.
What district would that be in?
The naming of Route 151, the Major Michael Martino USMC Memorial Highway in Nelson County.
The Lynchburg District, Mr. Chairman, and I move approval.
Excellent.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Administrative Services Division. Ms. Cheatham again. Any questions for Ms. Cheatham before we go and vote on this?
I move approval.
Second.
Thank you, sir.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Okay, none opposed? Excellent. Local Assistance Division. What do we got here?
It's me, Mr. Chairman, Mike Estes, Local Assistance Division. In front of the board today is a request for an approval for the commissioner to enter an agreement with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for an enhancement grant project that the board has approved some allocations in previous years. Basically, we'd like to allow the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to manage that project that previously was going to be managed by Northampton County.
So I'm sorry. So
Northampton.
Could you explain that a little bit more to me? I'd just like to make sure I understand.
Sure, I'll give that a shot, Mr. Chairman. Again, basically, the board every year will allocate allocations under the Transportation Enhancement Program. It's a mandatory set-aside program from our federal revenue. And what they have done is in the past, I think it's from 2007, 2008, 2009, have allocated $290,000 to a project in Northampton County. And based on the progress of that project and the dialogue between the county and the Fish and Wildlife Service, they have come to us and asked if they could transfer that money directly to the Fish and Wildlife Service because they have a similar project already ongoing on the National Refuge down there. And we've looked at that and agree with that movement. And with the powers of the board, the commissioner has the authority to enter an agreement with local governments, but cannot enter into an agreement with a national entity, or like the U.S. government, without the approval of the CTB. So that's why this action is in front of the board.
So tell me,
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
The resolution before us authorizes the commissioner to sign the agreement. A question, should that be the acting commissioner?
Yes, it should be. That's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Booth.
We'll get to that in a moment. We haven't gotten to a motion yet. I want to make sure I understand one thing. So the enhancement program, so that is federally mandated, a certain amount of our transportation money goes to it. So does that include also like the money that used to go towards like historic properties and stuff like that?
It does, sure, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
We have, actually, it's a thank you for that segue. If you would allow me to kind of remind the board of our application process, there is a one pager about the upcoming enhancement program where we annually receive. This year we got about 140 applications from all around the state, and this board is familiar with that process for how those applications are scored, and then the allocations are chosen and selected by the board. So in front of the board we have kind of a schedule based on the years past of how we've gone through that process. So that would be anything from there are actually 12 different categories of eligible activities, anything from depot restorations to acquisition of scenic battlefields and things like that. The board extensively worked with our division and with others over the past year to somewhat tighten that program for the eligible categories as well as funding limits and things like that. But we would love the opportunity to brief you on that as well, sir.
That is exactly where I was leading. Can we get a, have we ever actually, I'm sorry, done work sessions? I would really like to walk through and understand the program, what we're funding today, and also get some ideas about things we've funded in the past.
Okay. Love to. Yes, sir. This board will tell you the program represents around $15 to $20 million a year. I think the last couple of years it's been around $18 million. Where it's a small amount of money for the program that this board is responsible for, but I doubt anyone would argue that it generates quite a bit of interest for that type of money. So we've spent a lot of energy as this board trying to focus those allocations in the right direction, and have been working
over the last year, again, to bring more information to the board on the status of all the existing projects. We have quite a few that are in the mill right now as well.
Excellent. So I'm sorry. So who the which district? Would this be Hampton Roads District?
Hampton Roads District.
Mr. Lane, would you like to...
The Hampton Roads District would move that the transfer between VDOT and United States Fish and Wildlife Service be so...
With the amendment that...
With the amendment that the acting commissioner be able to sign the agreement.
Second. Dickens, you want to do...
Second.
Excellent. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Okay, none opposed. Excellent.
Thank you very much.
So we'll get... I'd like to get a work session on bringing them forward. Right away. Mr. Bennett?
Yes, sir. This section involves the CTB declaring certain portions of previous right-of-way surplus that would allow us to dispose of it either through sale or conveyance to a public entity. The first item is in Fluvanna County. It's on Route 15 at the intersection of 107. I don't know what additional information you'd like to have. All the information is... It was in the members' notebooks.
Okay. And I'm sorry, typically do we do A through D all together, or do we...
We usually do them separately, sir.
Okay. I wouldn't mind seeing this all listed by the district. Okay? Because, I want to reinforce that role.
Okay.
Fulvanna would be in Lynchburg? Where would Fulvanna be?
Culpeper,
I'm sorry. Okay.
Who's on approval?
Butch is not here today.
Exactly. I'm
on
approval.
Okay. We have a second.
Second.
Okay, all those in favor?
Aye.
Thank you very much. Bedford County, would that be Lynchburg or that
Salem?
Salem? Sorry?
That's another county.
My wife would be quite happy to point out
that it's Salem. I've got to get my map out. Where's one of those great maps we have out there?
That particular one is quite routine. The service that the previously held has now been taken over by the completion of 221 and taking into secondary under 860. I'm sorry, 870. There's nothing. No more value left on for us.
Excellent. You have a motion?
I move approval.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you very much. None opposed. Amherst?
That is in the Lynchburg district.
All right. I knew it was out there somewhere.
And I move approval.
You have a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Okay, not opposed. Spotsylvania. I know where Spotsylvania is. Good old too.
I move for approval, Mr. Chairman.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Okay, not opposed. Thank you.
The next item is limited access change, which the we're requesting the board to make a change to the limited access limits at Lewistown Road and I-95 in the Richmond District. So in order to accommodate a proposed project that's going to be advertised in next month or so.
Any questions?
Mr. Chairman, I move approval of this.
Second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Okay, none opposed. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Bennett. Programming Division, Ms. Mitchell.
Good afternoon. I'm presenting today the monthly transfers. We do this each month for the six-year program. All the transfers are coordinated with the board members prior to bringing them before you. Those transfers that are greater than 10% are brought for the board's approval, and a list of transfers less than 10% are provided for your information.
Anything interesting in that?
No, sir. Just covering a couple small project estimate increases.
Do we have any questions?
Mr. Chairman, I move approval of the Lynchburg District transfers.
Second. All those in favor?
Aye.
None opposed? Excellent. Any other transfers?
The other one is just for your information. The one in Northern Virginia, it's less than 10%.
Mitchell, great presentation. Appreciate it. Scheduling and contract. Mr. Hiles?
Hiles, that's correct, sir.
Okay.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I bring before you today roughly $36 million worth of projects. We have six projects here. You'll note that two of them are ARRA funded. We have four regular projects, one design build, and one by the Virginia Port Authority.
Okay.
With your concurrence, I would take those one at a time.
Any questions before I move? Okay. Let's take them one at a time.
On page one, first project is an RR project. It is adding 3 miles to Port Republic Road. You'll notice we had 6 bidders, good competition. We think it represents good value, and we'd like to recommend it for award.
Mr. Chairman, we're delighted that that came in under budget. We only wish we could use some of the under budget to shift into other projects, but we understand that we've approved a whole list of others that it will go to, so I move approval.
Excellent.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
None opposed? Next one.
Moving now to the second one on page one, order number DO3. This is Pouncey Track Road in Hanover County. We had even more competition. We had 7 bidders. We think it represents a good value. We'd like to recommend award to J.L. Kent.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, this project has been on the Hanover County drawing board for over a decade. I hope that they will be thrilled if you will vote to approve this today, and I move its approval.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
All none opposed? Excellent. Passes. Before we leave, can I just ask just a general question to you? You know, I recognize that obviously the economy is what it is right now, but you've been hearing that the actual equipment, the resources you put in the projects, actually the prices of let's say asphalt or steel, whatever, has remained steady. But we're generally seeing these types of price reductions from what our estimates were to what we're getting across the board.
We've been seeing that for a little better than a year now, and partly due to increased competition. Okay. 3 years ago, we would get about an average of 3 bids per project. We're almost to 6 now. Some projects we've been getting as many as 14 bids on, which is pretty unusual.
And I'm sorry, under our bidding process, I know I asked this question yesterday, so is it always lowest bid or is it best value?
On our traditional bid-build projects, it's all low bid. We do have the one design-build project here we're presenting, which has the design-build factors.
Okay, thank you very much.
Oh,
sorry, next item?
Best value. Okay, we're moving now to page 2. This is widening Route 610 in Stafford County. 6 competitors. We think it represents good value, and we'd like to recommend award to J.L. Kent.
Mr. Chairman, I'm passingly familiar with this specific section of road. It is taking where you currently have 4 lanes going down to 2 in a relatively developed area, projected level of service F, unless this upgrade is done, this will resolve that problem or that pending problem. So with that, I would like to move approval.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Ayes have it.
On page 3, we have one miscellaneous project. You will notice we had them structured by primary, secondary, and now we have a miscellaneous project because this is an on-call bridge repair and preventive maintenance contract for the Stanton District. And on-call means they'll make repairs when needed. We only had 2 competitors, but on this type of work, we usually only get 3. So everybody but one firm that usually does this work competed. We've analyzed the bids. We think they represent good value, and we'd like to recommend award to Lanford Brothers Company.
Mr. Chairman, I would move approval and thank the CTB for support for addressing a district that has almost as many bridges as Tidewater.
Hampton Roads.
Hampton Roads.
You just got a negative vote. All those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed? Ayes have it. Next item.
On page 4, we have our design-build project. This is to replace the Route 29 northbound bridge over the Ty River. This is in the Lynchburg District. We've analyzed these bids. We think we have good value here. We had 11 competitors. We'd like to recommend award to American Infrastructure.
Second.
11 competitors on this.
Yes.
Okay. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, so 11 competitors. Are they all from in-state, or are they...
There's a mixture.
What's that?
Predominantly in-state, but there's a mixture. We have, in fact, recently we're getting more competitors from out-of-state as the program gets smaller in those their home states.
That's amazing. I'm sorry?
That's all right, Mr. Chairman. I move approval. This is a very needed project. Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Ayes have it.
And now on page 5, we have a project that has to come before the board, but this was advertised and would be built by the Virginia Port Authority. This is to construct phase 2 of the Norfolk International Terminal's central rail yard. The locality analyzed the bids. They think they have good value. They presented that to us, and we would like to recommend award to Branscom Incorporated.
Okay, so I'm sorry. And then I just, again, trying to understand this. So why is this before us versus the VPA, the board?
It's using ARRA funds. The funds came through us.
Gotcha. Okay. But normally, if they're doing contracts for any sort of improvements actually on the port, it would not come before us.
It's actually quasi-private in the Port Authority.
Excellent.
Secretary Hampton Roads, this moves approval. Anything to do with the port that supports the rest of the state, we're very proud to do, so move approval.
We have a second.
Short.
Second.
Mr. Chairman, let the record state that I abstain from this vote.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed? Thank you very much. The ayes have it. Any other contracts?
Thanks. That's all I have today, sir.
I'm sorry. Before you leave, so generally, how many do we do of these at the board meeting?
About what we did today?
Recently, this has been about the normal number, 4, 5, 6 projects. During the peak times a few years ago, we might have as many as 20.
Right. And normally, you're getting the bids and actually making decisions right up to the board meeting. Is that correct?
I'm sorry.
The timing on this is normally that you're making this, you're getting bids in and making a decision on what to bring before us right up to the board meeting. That's why we don't see these beforehand.
That's correct, in this case.
Okay. Excellent. All right, well, thank you very much. Look forward to the next meeting. We're just going to take a very... Okay. We might just take a... Actually, if I just take a slight recess. The governor is on his way right now. So he's actually walking down the street, and the governor's probably shaking hands at the bus stop right now. So we'll give him a couple more minutes, but we told him 3 o'clock, and he'll be here at 3, exactly 3 o'clock. So we'll stay just in recess for just a couple moments. I can ask the board members if they just stay really back here in the dais here area so we can start as soon as he arrives here. So thank you very much.
So what was that number?
This number is...
Oh, okay, so this is over. They didn't underbid by that much. This is additional, and this will be... And I should have thought that sooner about you would not put right away that you're selling in here until after you have the original.
Right, right. Well, what we have to do is we're seeking permission to go
to
the briefing
to
to convey the right.
So
this is the board, this is VDOT's way of determining that it's not needed.
You know,
this condition is the board to go file with the seller.
But as long as it's within the years of time, like 10 years or something, then you would go back to that board.
Right.
Okay.
And we have a very specific rule in the state statute that selling land.
We're just talking about Midtown tunnel. That project moves.
Well, actually, I have thought over the years because I have had very
backed up areas that are directly
related
to repairs.
Yeah.
But so I'm very engaged in that issue.
Direction you had to choose in the mornings, obviously, rush out in the afternoon.
Does the best job. But there's a big thing that
and then on the weekends of summer,
eight,
12 miles, winter time, weekends.
I appreciate
you. Are you okay? But you've always been
exactly
the one who would go out.
If they knew, I know it's going to take an extra hour, but I know I'm going to rent for it.
Moving fast.
Yes.
You know, you did much more than that.
That's the problem.
Mine was a healthy
worry.
I always remain concerned about
that. Right.
Not a fun feeling to fight your own city.
Oh, yeah. I know what you mean. And you want.
Well, and I've seen a lot of dirty tricks for people, because people call me. They'll call me this to this day, and that was 89.
No,
you talk. It's okay.
For most of the I'm a blue dogger.
I am too.
I'm a conservative.
All right, can I ask everyone please return their seats? I'd like to, again, appreciate very much the board amending the agenda today, including this resolution. Before we actually take up this resolution, I would like to invite up the governor, His Excellency, the governor of the Commonwealth of Virginia, Robin McDonald.
Thank you. Let me just first of all welcome you and thank you for your public service on the Commonwealth Transportation Board. It's obviously a very important function that you serve in the Commonwealth of Virginia, and I appreciate many of you for your many years of service in this endeavor. I want to thank our new chairman and our Secretary of the Commonwealth, Sean Connaughton, for his leadership, and I want to say that there are many tough decisions you've had to make over the years. And no doubt many more that you will have to make. My job is to help make your job easier with providing the resources, the tools, the statutory and regulatory changes that will allow us to get roads, bridges, et cetera, built faster with less excuses, less delay, and more help from us. And that's what I want to do. Secretary Connaughton is absolutely committed to those goals, and that's why I ask him to serve in this position. He knows roads, rail, port from both local government and as a professional, and I think hopefully you've already found he'll be a good leader and a good teammate with you all in making your decision. So I want to say thanks so much for your service. I especially appreciate in such short order you docketing on your agenda what I think is an important public safety and transportation issue, and that is the reopening of Virginia's rest stops. I know you had some tough calls to make last year when you took up this matter and decided to reduce the number of operational rest stops
in Virginia, which caused 18 of them to be closed. I know that you are about to vote on this matter. I certainly urge you to vote in the affirmative to reopen these rest stops. We're going to help you in a number of ways to offset the public fund cost of those rest stops. We've already met with the Department of Corrections, where we believe we can get some help with nonviolent inmate labor to do some of the work without imperiling public safety in any way. We believe that a lot of leaders in the private sector have already assured me that they will be willing to help with an adopt a rest stop program with private sector funds that can reduce the operating costs. We already have talked to some of the folks that have been doing the contractual work and believe that they will certainly work with us to sharpen the pencil to reduce the cost to the Commonwealth Transportation Board for the services they provide. So all we need is your help and your authorization to get these back open. I can tell you that over the last couple months, many months actually, I don't think I've heard Mr. Secretary, people concerned about more things are talking to me more often about the need to reopen these restaurants for purposes of public safety, for convenience. Anybody that's driven in a car for more than a couple hours with small kids knows exactly what I'm talking about the importance of making this move today. So listen, I just want to say thanks so much. I look forward to working with you over the next 4 years on many, many important issues regarding transportation in this Commonwealth. But I think your vote here today in the affirmative for reopening the rest stops would help us immensely in making a step forward for the public to show we're serious about getting things done. So, Mr. Secretary, thank you very much. That's the only comments I have, and I'll let you continue with the meeting. Thank you very much.
Governor, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Governor, again, thank you very much for being here, and thank you for your comments. Can I ask for a motion on this resolution?
Yes, sir.
We have a second?
Second.
Before we vote, I do want to particularly want to thank the staff at VDOT, Mr. Worley, Ms. Busher, Ms. Sorrell, for helping put together this plan in very short order, looking at the operational aspects, the budgetary aspects, and you know, how we're going to look at setting up a long-term plan to find ways to keep these centers open at the lowest cost possible to the taxpayer. And under the resolution, under the plan, just remind the board, the first set of rest stops will be the opening by February 17th. The next flight will be open by March 17th, and by April 15th, all the rest stops will be open all the rest stops will be open to the public by April 15th. So with that, I ask all those in favor of the resolution?
Aye.
All those opposed? Resolution passes. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. And with that, we are now, the meeting is adjourned, unless there's any other further new business? No? With that, we have a motion to adjourn.
Move adjourn.
I have a second. All those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed? Huh? Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. The meeting's adjourned.
Are we still where we need to go to you before our communications with the public? Okay, you'll get back to Jennifer. I'll tell her I asked and they answered, so yeah. Okay, I just want to make sure. Thanks. Well, thank you. I hope that happens next time, too. It's just our normal. Okay. Well, thank you for your service.
Well, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Kathy Byron is one of my dear friends, as we really keep up me.
Yeah, we're all good. I think I go way back. I'm a lawyer. I'm almost a
Lacey. Don't look it, but Lacey was my seedling for 9 years I served in Virginia.
I'm a
you're the other end, so I didn't get to see you well.
I'm
sorry. What was your name?
Over there. We're going to do some things to make it a little easier and probably ask for some other things to audit and some other things to help you get the advice from outside that will help make the place run a little better. But thanks for agreeing to serve. I'm really, really thankful.
No problem. Thanks, Max.
Yes, sir.
Kevin and Jerry McCarthy.
Yes, Jerry, how you
been? We met last September.
We did.
Nice to see you. Thank you for coming over today.
Well,
thanks a lot.
Davis and I and a couple of others made. We were not happy when we had to do this and we voted it. It wasn't a unanimous vote.
I do know that.
So we're thrilled that you want to reopen it so quickly.
So we know everybody else.
Yeah, right.
Former president. After about 2 weeks of sleep, I'm determined to get a good night tonight so I can get my back.
I'm very pleased,
I'm glad.
Yes, she did. Yes,